I think that's going to bring to me a whole new set of challenges that I've never really dealt with.
And then the internationalization of data should be a really nice challenge as well.
So in terms of scale, it's a huge step up in scale.
Right.
And I'm just like, bring it. I'm like, bring it, I'm ready. I may get hurt doing this, but I'm ready.
Well, you'll certainly learn a lot. Yeah, that's for sure.
And that's the piece that I really find exciting about enterprise IT is, and you and I have talked about this, in a theoretical vacuum, we can work pretty much anything we want out.
Yeah.
And then once you get into an enterprise trench, you're doing this.
Yeah.
Practical implementation. Whole other ballgame.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I left here and I couldn't understand why Dell couldn't sell me a Turing machine that did everything. Give me the Turing machine. Infinite storage, infinite.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, just one second. Hello? I'm in a meeting. Can I call you as soon as I'm done? Okay.
Yeah. Well, the best one we heard, and I think I told you the story, was one of our CCIOs came and said, I want to buy software that looks at this code and tells me if this software does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do anything it should.
Verification. It's an unsolved problem.
And Mike's like,
yeah, no, you're not.
But you can't do that. She goes, well, why not? This vendor says they can do it. He's like, no, they can't. but why? It seems reasonable. It's like, no, you can't. But it's the halting problem.
If maybe not quite that bad.
An instance of.
I mean, even for restricted domains, where you can specify completely, verification is hard. And I mean, if you go and talk to Professor Shudong He will tell you a lot more than I can. I mean, we try to do, hey, how are you doing? Where are you these days?
Huh?
Where are you?
Working now.
Yeah, where?
I am Humana.
Humana? Oh.
Yeah.
So you're giving everyone insurance?
Yeah. No.
It's good to see you. Good to see you. Are you coming back to school?
Yeah, so I'm trying to.
Oh, good. Yeah, for masters?
Yeah, for the masters.
Great.
Science.
Great. I look forward to seeing you in class. Yeah,
probably will see you in operating systems again.
Okay, great.
Well,
okay.
See you.
Good to see you. Yeah, so.
You can't do that. Why? Because you can't. Trust me, you can't.
Yeah.
And if the company did, they should publish. You solve the problem, is it going to be a great forefather in CS now?
Yeah. And, certainly, I think. And in your case, you had problems in the trenches that you saw and then which you brought back into the class, which is equally rewarding for academics, right? I mean, because real problems are hard to find. I mean, and academics are good at manufacturing fake problems.
If I had this and that, I have this problem, but you don't have either one.
I've never heard anybody quite say it like that, but it is so true. You know, I've been thinking a lot about what I'm going to do PhD research wise, and it's like, so what problems are there that really I can, you know, dig into?
I don't want to give you the wrong idea. There are really, you know, well-grounded researchers in academia who work a lot with industry. So they know the real problems. And they have, let's say, students who go out to work for short periods of time and then come back, right? And they come back with even more problems. And so right now, I feel there are two camps of researchers, one who claim that real research at scale, systems research, can no longer be done in academia because academia just doesn't have the kind of infrastructure to inform us of real problems. And then there's this other camp which says, if you look at it from that granularity, it may appear to be true, but in reality what's happening is that researchers are collaborating with industry folks. I, for instance, collaborate with people in IBM, in VMware, and in NetApp, in a couple of other places.
Right.
So I get to talk to them very frequently and I hear what, you know, the problems are. And then once in a while we have people like Robert coming directly from, you know, experiencing the real thing and coming to class with a real problem that they want to work on. So that is happening. So you cannot take a very coarse-grained view and say,
there's no absolutes in anything.
Yeah. Yeah, so 0. Yeah.
So those aren't even that absolute.
The rising and falling into the clock is still an iffy thing, okay?
Yeah.
It's not quite 1, and it's not quite 0.
I agree.
Okay, so I think our first thing is to get you up to speed on what you've been banging our heads against so far. And I don't know if you got a chance to look at the few paragraphs that...
Yeah, I did. I did skim them. I didn't, spend a lot of time on it.
Okay, yeah. So, that's a very high-level description, and it's not completely filled out yet. And that's still something that, one of the things that we might want to discuss later today. But I would probably ask Robert to, sort of lead the discussion, and I'll keep filling in as if it is necessary.
And we actually started to talk about this at work for the last 20 or 30 minutes or so.
Well, we've been talking over time, too.
Yeah, we've been talking over time. But conceptually, what we're trying to solve is, on a higher level, and it's one of the questions in the introduction of the paper, is given some storage device I have today, and some workload attached to that storage device, and there's multiple flavors of the question, so I got to be careful. I want to bring this new workload in to the existing storage device with the existing workload, and what impact is that going to have on top of, and I'm getting into a flavor of the question, what impact is that going to have on the existing workload and the existing storage configuration? So the kind of the consolidation perspective. Can I, given these metrics that I have to sustain, bring this new workload in with this current storage config, will this play nice in the sandbox together? If not, and this is the question really has multiple flavors to it, if not, how much additional storage in terms of devices do I need to purchase to sustain these two workloads? Another spin on that question would be, I have this existing workload, I have this existing storage config, it's not performing sufficiently, how much more do I need to buy in terms of spindle?
Yeah, right. I think we talked about that, and we sort of said that the model, until you can quantify, because there's so many details, like, obviously, unless, again, in an academic model, this might not be true, but the real model, the real world, right, there's obviously the question of how is on the disk, right, in the sense that, you might have 107 LUNs, or 107 spindles, and you may actually have them shared across all of them. You may have it shared across just 14 of them. So how you're modeling it and to answer those questions, all those details have to be in there because, as we, I think we know pretty clearly, it's, answering that question is not a yes or no. Even if you give them a lot of data, there's still other questions,
And this is kind of where... And I have, I'm kind of stuck in that boat, and you and I have talked about this, where we've been going back and forth for months, because we don't want something so grossly complex, with so many variables to plug in, that somebody's going to look at it and say,
well, it's not worth the effort.
What? No, forget it. I'll deal with what I've got today.
It's easier to solve halting. Okay.
No.
I
won't go that far. But something that's going people are going to look at it and like,
Yeah,
it completely blows their mind, and by virtue of its complexity, it may be right on the money and dead accurate, but so daunting that nobody wants to use it.
Yeah. Right. Well, so then you have to, perhaps. So I guess I'm stuck with So I can see modeling the simple, very simplest one, right? 100% random or 100% sequential or whatever it is, right? It's obviously a very simple case, but then you end up realizing when you have multiple spindles. And you have, different LUNs carved out. They're all going to different servers, which are producing different workloads. There's some component of shared infrastructure that has to be computed too, right? In that model. So you can get down to, well, I'm only interested in these 14 disks. But you have to consider the bus, the back-end bus. You have to consider the storage processor. And I'm just thinking in a simple EMC model. Obviously you change the controller module, and the architecture, all, and everything's different too.
Right.
But, if you look simply at that, that's, I guess mid-tier, anything that's in that EMC class of, like, Clarion, for example, or Pods or whatever, then there are the shared components you have to also factor. And I think you can't really have a model unless you
kind
of all those pieces.
To jump in a little bit here, I feel that there are some problems that are easy and then some problems which are hard, sub-problems. Right? Right. For instance, the bus and capacity is the easier problem. The harder problem is what happens inside the disk drives and what happens because of consolidation of multiple workloads which have footprints in different areas of the
disk. Right, and then you're going...
Right, so yeah. So I think there are some assumptions that are reasonable to make here. For instance, to say that, okay, the bus is adequately provisioned.
Okay.
And so that's not going to be a bottleneck. And we can rely on things like, okay, EMC is going to give the right guidance as to what kind of backplane should exist if your storage system look like this, right? So that the bus doesn't become a bottleneck. So we can make some of those assumptions and so that we are sort of immediately forced to think about what are the harder problems that really...
Right, that's what I was trying to kind of say, is that there's so much other fluff.
Yes.
Where are we going to go? I had a problem wrapping when you were describing it around my mind around that part.
And that's kind of where, number one, and you know me, I like complete things even if they're complex. But one of the things to address the complexity that we've talked about is basically what I do for you on my whiteboard is a decomposition of the components of the model such that they can be used independently. And I think we talked about this a few weeks ago.
Right.
You know, here's your device model. Here's your workload model. You know, okay, now put these two together and you get this. And so you kind of build it from components that roll into each other to ultimately say, okay, you got number 17. I'm picking
right.
an arbitrary value. Or you got these six tuples that say da-da-da-da-da-da. You know what you need to do to keep it simple. But you're right. They're like going all the way to follow your train of thought and conversation. Okay, I have 8 disks. Well, what's the stripe size on it now? What RAID configuration are they in? You know, what's the transfer size coming from the host versus the stripe size across the LUN for the 8 disks? Okay, I have a 64K stripe and a 4K transfer. What does that really mean? There's a lot of the granular, what does that really do? You know? And then one of the things that we've talked about that's even more complex to deal with is once you get into the whole caching space.
Yeah, well, obviously, right, is even the necessarily... How it's right, which is catching, is how is it going to, you know, obviously if you try to write them constantly in order, you might flip them up back and forth between them. But if you did, you know, 50 here and then 50 there, obviously it's a huge win.
Mm-hmm. Scheduling.
Yeah. So, but I'm just sort of thinking in terms of, you know, even sequential, I'm trying to keep it simple. You still think about the sequential as if you just have 2 transaction logs for the others, you know, screaming along. As soon as you put them
together,
you're not writing sequential workload anymore. You take a sequential workload and broken it into 2 sequential workloads, which now are...
have some degree of random, and that's what we talked about, consolidating.
Yeah.
And one from the previous work, and I'm going to have to share a lot of that with you, but from the previous work, the statement I made was that which you believe to sequential is not necessarily sequential. And you and I have talked about this.
We always saw that.
In a multi-user environment, you know, even streaming media, okay, fine. I have 2 users streaming 2 different sources of media. You would typically believe the streaming media is sequential. Read along. Oh, wait, second user, now he wants this file.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Read, move. That stride introduces something that could be quantified as a degree of randomness into the workload, even though you have a sequential workload. So these are all,
and that's where you start getting the benefits though of your read-ahead caching and all that crap.
Right.
That benefits you, but it still means you're
indeed
still there. You're still moving back and forth.
So these are all problems that exist in the work.
Yeah.
That we don't necessarily have.
So what are we trying to bite into? That's sort of what I stuck. I mean, a lot of it, I don't know to the extent you know what has been done because I know you've done some readings on it, but you know where are we wanting to bite in, which problem? Because there is we talk about a very broad space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a very broad space, I agree.
I think some of the things we've talked about in terms of assumptions or exclusions mm-hmm. from the work is once you start to get into the scheduling space of IO or the caching algorithms for mm-hmm. managing your cache and the partitioning strategies for that cache, build that into the model such that it's some K or pluggable function that says, look, do your own
scheduling analysis, you know, and plug it into the model. You know, if you swap out, you know, FIFO for completely fair queuing, you know, put the value you have to quant for somebody else's work. You need to quantify what your impact of going from, you know, FIFO to CFQ. You have to plug that value into this K because it's going to weigh the model out now somehow.
But is it really just a K? I mean,
right. It probably won't be. And I'm glad that we're having this conversation because I don't think we've talked about the assumptions for the caching and the scheduler in much detail. My view on it is a little different, and I think that scheduling is very hard to model. I mean, any scheduler behavior, because it's inherently tied into your workload. Right? So the same scheduler can behave very differently for different workloads. So, and I think that it's going to be extremely hard to model the behavior of the scheduler. There are people who have done that for single workloads from a theoretical standpoint and evaluated using simulation as academics like to do a decade ago. Now, of course, simulation no longer is a preferred method of evaluating things. But I think, you know, in a real system, there's so much going on with scheduling and the dynamics that it's going to be very hard to model. So what we can model is having no scheduler at all, right? And say, okay, if there was no scheduler and everything was first in, first out, then what happens? Now, of course, there are some things which we do not have control over. For instance, inside the disk, right? And disk drives are very complex devices themselves. There is command queuing, and then you know Quest you can forward. Send out multiple outstanding requests, and then they get sorted out inside the disk. So I think all that will be factored out in the measurements that we will do for various workload patterns, right? So if you're doing a random, we'll see that random. The average latencies for random IOs are not the latencies for a single random IO, but in fact gets averaged out, and the averaging factor, or the amortization is the right word here, okay, depends on the rate at which these random IOs are coming in, right? So the rate random IOs are coming in 1 a second, then you're going to move a lot more than if they were coming in a lot quicker,
right?
So those sorts of things will be accounted for as part of the model because we're going to generate all those workloads. And we'll observe that and create some sort of a model, right? The assumption for caching, I think, is even more complex because...
We're recording this, right?
Yeah, we are. And because with scheduling, you have... You can argue a limited set of possibilities, but with caching, the number of possibilities are infinite, and the algorithms themselves can be arbitrarily different across storage vendors.
Absolutely.
And there's this other issue that caches can also be of different capacity. If you change the capacity, the behavior becomes very different.
It changes.
So I think to start with, what we have been thinking about is look at a no caching scenario, right? Where we disable the driver device, well, controller cache.
And OS cache.
And the OS cache, and see what do we get. And then there are, of course, limits to what we can do. We cannot, for instance, disable drive-level caching, because that's not controllable in all cases.
Yeah.
You can disable write buffering, but you cannot disable read caching. Right? So you have all those limitations. Now, how do we justify such an assumption that we model?
It's a good question.
Yeah, how that we model for a controller that with cache disabled, and we can say that assuming a reasonable controller, which with caching enabled, only improves performance, we are modeling in some sense
the worst case,
or something worse than what you might expect in reality. So, and it is perfectly okay to use that as a provisioning mechanism as long as the gap between what we get is not significantly different from what you would get with the caching turned on. Right? Now, that's one way of looking at the problem. The other way of looking at the problem is to say, okay, I have two configurations. And the first configuration is independent of the controller because caching is disabled. The other configuration is specific to a controller. which has a certain amount of cache and a certain amount of, you know, or a certain model for the controller with specific algorithms, and we model for that specific storage system. And then the contribution is how we create the model for that specific controller, and we say that the process of creating the model can be reproduced for an arbitrary controller. Mm-hmm. So if you go through the same process for your controller, you can create, instantiate a model for it.
Go ahead,
So this is sort of two different ways of looking at this caching issue from very different standpoints.
And one of the things we threw out in previous conversations was an idea that you and I toyed with, your idea about the n-tuple to describe the device. You know, and say, okay, we can create an abstract, generalized model for devices. And, you know, you plug in how much write cache you have.
Yeah, but I think he points out those things, some of the things are...
You don't know.
You just can't put it up. You can't...
You cannot...
How do you describe... It goes back to, like, you know, can you look at a program and see if it's right? Right? Mm-hmm. You can't look at an algorithm and say it's really well expressed in even a number.
In closed form. I mean, yeah. It may be even more complex. I mean, even if I had a closed form, which is a quadratic expression, that may not be sufficient to describe the algorithm completely, because it may be like piecewise function. Say, okay, it behaves
certain way
in this range, but then when you move on to this other range, it behaves completely differently, and then you move on, and then you cannot even have a single closed form.
That we don't even see the algorithm, so we don't even really know. We can't even look at it to express it, to determine if we can express it in any way.
Yeah, I mean, caching algorithms are, you know, that's a whole different research area, right? People are always, you know, making it better and making it more complex.
More aware.
It's going to be, I think that's a very difficult path to go into.
So it's sort of the
situation looks very bleak, right? I mean,
but that's good.
But does that mean that we shouldn't do anything?
No, of course not.
Right, and if we are sort of in this mode that we have to do something to make the situation better than what it is right now, because right now is, you know, just rules of thumb and experience based, right? Which may be good enough if your storage is static, but it's changing and growing, and you want to do all kinds of fancy things with it, right? Like consolidation. So you cannot afford to say, okay, I'm going to use my rules of thumb from several years before and all the experience that I've gathered on this one storage system and apply it to another one or a different one.
Or my favorite, just buy a lot more than you need.
we were talking about.
Greatly over-provisioning
is probably one of the most common strategies.
Well, greatly over-provisioning, and I think that's a common solution, right? But the problem is you don't even know how much you are over-provisioning. It's very hard because... You may be, in fact, consolidating the wrong workloads, and if you had not done consolidation, or if you had consolidation, you may require 10 times as much less.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with that, because if you look at the enterprise strategy we followed, right, we went from an idea of, what, 5 years ago, 6 years, more now, 7 years ago, of having every machine had its own disk, and that was the way it was, to a strategy where we're now trying to put everything
on shared storage.
On a shared storage scenario, and I think the number of disks we have has probably increased, and we're getting a lot more I/O through every disk. And the funny part is, those disks before were super adequate because they barely spun. I mean, you know, if you looked, the lights would barely blink, you know, in the cabinet, right, for this average pizza box server. And then turn around now, and we have, you know, I don't know, 100 disks in the cabinet, and they're all constantly reading and writing, but are we really getting anything better out of it? Is it this? And in some cases, performance is absolutely worse. You know, we know that certainly we've got some configuration issues, but it's absolutely worse in some scenarios.
And in other scenarios, and this is what really spawned the idea at the beginning of last semester, is because not all of the trays are massed together. You go look at two of them, and they're, and then you look at four others, and they're like flick, 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 and you're like, that's grossly underutilized, and this thing's burning.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm, that's true.
Can I put these together, and what am I going to get by doing that? What's the impact to him by doing that, and what's?
And then there's the factor of time, right? You know, some stuff only runs at night, and some stuff only runs during the day. You know, and vice versa. You know, maybe if you came in at night, you find all the flick flicks are going nuts, and the things that are going nuts are quiet.
Well, I've done that part. Because the things that are going nuts actually do more work at night than they do in the day. I'm thinking to see the disk. I run the maintenance plant at night. Trust me.
So the question is, if you consolidate, you know, I guess sort of the thought I'm thinking is that, you know, does that mean that we badly organize across the those 100-some-odd spindles? And, you know, would it be better if we shared them out?
Well, that's a subset of the general problem. That's where I started.
Right.
Okay, the original work was called DISQA.
This what?
DISQA, DSQA. DSM, SSM, Quantitative Analysis. And I started off with that subset of where we are today. Like, I have these workloads, they have their dedicated spindle models.
Right, yeah, I remember that.
I can guarantee the performance for this, it's never going to go below this, it's never going to go above this. The dedicated model. The shared model said, well, I'm just going to take all of this disk and put it together. And what am I going to get out of that?
Right.
And where are the pain points? And that was really a subset of where we are today, which is more of the generalized consolidation question. You know, a model for adding disk, removing disk, adding work model, or removing disk is still.
So if you answer the question that basically says if I have 16 disks, so I don't know if this question is answered yet. If I have 16 disks and two workloads that are, I don't know what they are, ? Workloads, is it ever better to have them 8 and 8, or always better to have them 16, or always better to, you know, is there a fundamental answer to that question?
There's, we would like to answer that question in this work.
Okay. Right.
Because that question thus far has not been answered.
Because that seems like a real problem that people have.
Right, and that's a subset of where we are today, and that's where we started. That's the question I originally wanted to answer in January of last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the more work I did, I'm like...
That's the sort of low-hanging fruit for an administrator, right?
Yeah.
So I have two storage systems, and they do different things. And I see that one guy is doing a lot more than the other guy. And the easiest way, perhaps, to improve performance is to put them together.
Right.
And at the same time,
consolidate the number of disks.
That's the low-hanging fruit for the storage systems administrator, and that's where we started, right?
Okay.
But I think to answer that question, we'll end up creating solutions for even more intricate and more, substantial problems, which is goes up higher up in the tree of what kind of optimizations become possible if we were to answer questions of that kind, right? So, for instance, I have a new workload that's sitting somewhere else. I have an existing set of spindles which are underutilized. What if I move that other workload and free up that resource and consolidate, right? And what's the impact going to be on not just the first workload, but on both workloads, right? And now I can do more interesting optimizations. I can, you know, not just put the set of spindles that I have together, but also eliminate spindles. And
yeah,
use that.
That becomes a subset only of you answered the question of, well, now it's better if I put it all 16. I don't even know that that's a necessary truth, right? That's
maybe 8 is enough.
Yeah.
But if 8 is enough, then 16 is guaranteed even better.
Indeed.
True.
Right? Okay. I think that's probably,
yeah.
Maybe. I hope it's
that's
a tautology, right?
I think
add more disk is better.
I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Yeah. So
equal or better, because you might
so
have
the question
a bus
is what I don't know is 16 disks able to handle two? Let's look at it really simply. It's the sequential workloads, right? We know we'll get ripping 8 disks sequential workload and another separate 8 disks with sequential workload. Is that workload going to be impacted when I put on 16 disks?
Yes,
sort of
cross,
and is it going to be less? Am I going to get more performance or less performance?
You can get both. No, you can get both.
Well, it depends. If the if the bursts of the workloads,
yes.
And this is where we got into.
Is that time? Is
the time in between them? If do the work for one, and now I have 16 disks, right? If they're interleaved such that they don't collide with each other, you don't have the stride across the platter, and then you're going to be much better off.
Yeah, and also, I mean, even if they were. What you are talking about is a case where I have the first sequential workload for a period of time, and then I have the second sequential workload for a period of time. That's one case where actually the performance will improve. Another case is even if they were going at the same time, but they're going at different rates. if they're going at different rates, let's say one is going at 1,000 megabytes, or, well, I don't know whether that's a reasonable number. Let's say 100 megabytes per second. The other guy is going at 5 megabytes per second. Even then, the performance will increase. The average performance will increase because the 1,000 megabytes per second will get all the spindles. 100 megabytes, and then the 5 megabytes per second can have a little bit reduced performance, but not substantially worse that it would sort of overtake the gain that you have in the other workload. So
that's a problem.
It's an interesting problem.
But has that problem been modeled out where we can actually see that, or is that really just sort of I've done the work and I can tell you that from my experience.
That's what we are doing today, right? I mean, we are saying that, okay, storage admins try various things, and then they have their cheat sheet of rules of thumb to say, okay, this and this goes well together, this and this doesn't. And then if you have a new problem to solve, you go back to your reference sheet and then you apply.
I guess I haven't seen the reference sheet.
Well, I mean, it's inside your head.
Yeah, no, I believe there are certain things that absolutely you come from experience and you say, well, I've done that. But I'm sort of working is there a somewhere in the body of knowledge that we have, whether it be CS body of knowledge or administrative body of knowledge, which hopefully has some of that. I know. Don't go there. But is there? Have we equivocally documented that into the body of knowledge and built the model that supports that, that shows it, rather than just the, yeah, I know it works because I did it.
Well, yeah. I mean, we are going after more fundamental science to answer such questions. Right?
That's what I'm trying
to ask. Say. Okay. Well, I know for sure that it will work this way because here's the science behind it.
That's what I'm asking.
Right? That's what we want to do with this work. It has not yet been done.
Okay, that's what I was asking.
I was about to answer that question. For the first 6 weeks of the Disco work, and we don't have a really good name for this one yet, we're like Quicksand. We're not sure.
Quicksand, I like that one best.
Yeah, we're working on a name. But for the first 6 to 8 weeks of the Disco work, that's where I tore into the body of knowledge. I went into the IEEE, I went into the ACM, I went into the general academic publications body, I started to pull papers, print, and look and say, did somebody already solve this?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there substantial progress in a direction that I can use to start from there and go forward? And in the end, I came up pretty much empty-handed.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got, 600-700 pages of printed out papers that I went through, and there's interesting things that we could use,
mm-hmm.
and bits and pieces we can borrow from other people, but nobody that just said, look, here it is. This is it.
This is a classic case of where industry is ahead of research.
It might be proprietary knowledge for companies.
It could be.
No,
it could be proprietary.
I'm sure they do have stuff. They have to know about their own stuff.
But I won't be surprised if it's not yet done, even inside the industry.
Well, in a general case,
because
no, I don't think it is.
In storage, there is a lot of representation of industry. We have, the flagship conference for storage is this conference called FAST, which is run by this organization called Usenix.
Sponsored by the ACM, by the way.
Well, it has no relation to ACM.
Really? I thought Usenix...
No. Usenix is a completely independent entity. Then you have two other computing associations, ACM and IEEE.
Oh.
And Usenix is actually getting more and more popular. In fact, I would argue that most of the systems work, the good systems work, comes out of Usenix.
Really? I don't know why I had thought that ACM and Usenix were related.
Well, they do some conferences together, but very, very small percentage.
Gotcha.
Usenix is an independent entity.
Where is it, by the way?
It's I don't know where the headquarters are.
No,
it's
FAST.
FAST?
Yeah.
So far, it has always been in the San Jose area. But if you go to these conferences, there are people from all the major storage players like NetApp, EMC, there are folks from VMware.
I've seen, in terms of talking to some of the... Remember that guy? I can't remember his name. But they came, he was there.
Dwayne,
yeah. He was their guy, right?
They've done
modeling, of course, for a particular product, So they can eliminate the question of, well, does it work on 15 different ones? No, it's not a general problem. They've solved it for specific configurations, if you have one disk, two disks, 16 disks, all the way out, probably out to whatever the maximum hardware is. And I've seen them, you know, build very good tables, you know, where they can talk about particular workloads that they've been able to test and see in their product with their configurations. You know, okay, if you want, you have 16 disks, and you rate them in 10 and 10, this is the number of IOPS you can sustain from each of those lines. I mean, where, you know, and how they do it, right? It's word of force, right? They wrote out all the configs they wanted to have, and, you know, brute force test them.
And that works for that specific instrument.
Yes. Yeah. So that's, I think, where they are, because that answers the kind of question they need most of the time.
Yeah, but the thing is that they have to make assumptions about the workload, even for that kind of table to be produced, right? And what we are trying to do here is to do a more substantial modeling of the workload itself and say that workload can be described in a meaningful way using parameters like what is the average I/O size, what is the reads to write ratio, what is the random to sequential ratio,
what is the rate
at which these I/O operations are being issued. So you can more substantially describe your workload if you had access to a richer vocabulary, right? And that's what we are trying to get at with this work, to say, okay, and to say that, okay, well, you don't have to worry about that. There is a way to extract these workload parameters given a workload trace, for instance. Okay, give me a trace of your IOP or your set of IOs that you're doing on your system, and I can
tell you
what your workload looks like. And then these parameters can be plugged into any model that we create and answer questions related to consolidation, related to performance. And
that goes back sort of the problem where I told you about multi-tuple. So I think that I'm trying to, in my mind, wrap my mind around what are the things, the outcomes that we're trying to get. So if it is a model of, then I think, you know, model the storage, so, you know, and model the workload, I think that seems understandable. It seems, you know, is a actual usable, workable.
Mm-hmm. I think we broke down, we got a screenshot of the kinds of things that we wanted to get out of it, but one of them was like model a single workload, which substantial work's been done and we can piggyback from.
Mm-hmm.
Model a device, which not a lot of work has been done.
So we're talking about modeling a single workload. If someone has a model of what a single workload looks like, you want to be able to do what is a consolidated workload. It seems to me
that's
fairly. I guess maybe it's because I've simplified in my mind what a single workload looks like, but it seems to me that it shouldn't be very complicated to take two of these object X, combine them, X plus Y, and get some Z.
Yeah, and we have some ideas as to how you could create a consolidated workload model, right? And then your problem becomes given, so I take workload A, workload B, when I consolidate that, I get a workload C.
Right.
Then the problem is, what is the performance of workload C on a given storage system, right? Which is, what is the workload of, what is the performance of any workload on a storage system? Right? And if you can answer that question.
And obviously your workload changes. Your workload is the input, but also your workload is a result of the performance of the system, right? So as your system slows down, your workload has to
slow down,
change, right? I mean, obviously they can't provide, if the storage system can't provide that forward workload, that workload ultimately morphs because
And that became we originally in the original Disco work we used because some of the work that we've based ourselves on is Gulati from VMware. I think I shared the paper with you.
Yeah, I think so.
The Bazel stuff, the automated DRS load balancing for storage.
Don't remember it.
Okay. He used as input to his model outstanding IO from the workload. And we had been going down that track. And the original Disco work was varying read and write, random to sequential, and the amount of outstanding I/O. And I think maybe 4 or 6 weeks ago, we had a conversation, and we came kind of to the realization, we're like, yeah, wait a minute. Outstanding I/O is not an input to the workload.
Yeah.
It is an output of what you have been put on top of. Because this particular workload on RAID 5 fiber channel might have these OIOs. But put it on RAID 10 SATA, you might have this OIO. Now put it on solid state, you might not have any OIO. It's a result, and we were talking about it's based on the range on the model. And so that's when we switched and we said, OIO is going to be an output, and we really looked at the IO rate
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that writing. It's not just a rate. It's not just the, it's also the randomness of it or the sequentialness of it.
Right.
There's a lot to be said about it.
Right, but that's where we're
and that's what we're talking about the model.
Yeah.
So
right.
We can now refer to it as a tuple of some set of numbers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But that's where we swapped out and we said, okay, OIO's got to go because it's not really a part of the model.
Yeah.
IO rate is part of the model.
IO rate, and then there are, of course, modifying parameters such as read-write ratios, random to sequential, average size. So we were looking at a graph which looks like this, which is, okay, given that the rest of the parameters are constant, if I increase the IO rate, what would happen to an observable parameter like IO latency, right? And so if I'm plotting, let's say, IO latency versus IO rate, what should it look like? So, and what we said was, okay, if I have like really small IO rates, my latency should be constant,
right?
So it's going so slow that there's infinite amount of time between two IO requests, and the latency is going to be governed simply by what the device can do, right? So, of course, if I'm using an SSD, the latency is going to be low, and if I'm using SATA, it's going to be substantially higher than if I were using SAS or FiberTime. In any case, I'm looking at a range in the IO rate where the latency remains constant. Right? But then at some point, the rate at which the IOs are being generated matches the rate at which they get completed. Okay? Or, and then I sort of see queuing. And the effect of queuing is a steady increase in the IO latency. Right? And then at some point, you know, what we were thinking of is beyond a certain point when the device, so there is a device has a certain capability as to how many outstanding IOs that it can accept and optimize on. And if the rate exceeds that so that the queue builds up or builds up much faster than the device can actually get back to you on, then we have something like this. Right? And what we are using to recreate this behavior so that we can model it by generating workload.
That's the piece I was telling you about on the way. Those are the boundaries we're looking for. And actually
right.
There's...
Right, so this is sort of the behavior that we expect. And the goal of the modeling work is to able to come up with a description of this behavior. So that given a workload, I have this sort of behavior for all instances of the other parameters of the workload, such as read-write ratio, randomness, and sizes, and so on. Right? And there is going to be this sort of behavior or some variant of this sort of behavior as we change the IO. Right?
So what is this, I guess I'm going to call it the Z-axis for this. You iterated through them, but I wanted to kind of have you repeat them. So you want to have this graph for all of what? I'm sorry. That was the part. So sort of like the z-axis, if you will. It's
transfer for sizes,
need
to write distribution, random to sequential distribution,
right?
In addition to the IO rate.
Okay. That was what those were.
Right. But it's not that I mean, the goal is not to create this graph.
No, I'm
right?
just...
Or these set of graphs. What we want in the end is some sort of a model for the performance. So I want a model for, let's say, latency, given a workload that is described by the rate, but also a whole bunch of other parameters, such as the read-to-write ratio, the random-to-sequential.
Transfer size.
Yeah, transfer size, and maybe some other things. And then we talked about things like workload volume footprint. So even if my workload were random, depending on the footprint of the workload, my latencies can change. Does my footprint span the entire disk? Or does it span just a few cylinders of the disk? And the random latencies can be very different in these two cases. So, and this becomes important even, there are additional parameters when you think about consolidation, such as workload volume footprint separation. Right, how far away these workloads are, things like that.
Right, the volume footprint of the workloads, and then the distance between the two footprints
right.
on the disk.
Right, So we can continue making this arbitrarily complex, but I have a sense that if you want to keep it simple, we had to make certain assumptions and say, okay, if I have two workloads, then their volume footprints are sort of adjacent to each other. If there are three, then you know these three are adjacent to each other rather than arbitrarily separated. I mean, if we make some of those workloads, we can eliminate these parameters because in the end, our strategy to come up with this function is to do all this, you know, generation of various workloads, measure these values, and retrofit and create these this model. So the more parameters we have, the more errors we can potentially introduce in the modeling process, right? So it is better to have a simpler model and explicitly lay out the assumptions than to create a really complex model, which is going to be very hard to describe and probably hard to use. So even, for instance, we can assume that transfer size is going to be 4 kilobytes or some reasonable value, right? And say, okay, we're just making that assumption and so that we have a simplistic model that people can use very quickly for whatever it is that they do.
That's pretty much where we're at.
Right.
That's the high level.
Right. So this, in some sense, is the workload model, this set of parameters, right? And then this function transformation actually will introduce modifiers based on the storage performance, right? So the latency is going to be the influence of the storage system on the workload.
So it's almost like a two-parameter function, right? Yeah. One would be given this workload, comma, given this storage system.
Right.
What is the latency?
Right.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah.
So what you have to define, obviously, right, what those two things are.
But it's something like f of g of f of
write it
because g comma h.
Yeah.
So g is the workload, h is the device.
Right.
F of both of those together gives you output.
Right.
And latency is the key of what we're looking at here.
Yeah, that's a discussion that we want to have today as well, because there are two classes of workloads, right? There are batch workloads, and then there are interactive workloads. And we talked about this yesterday briefly. And what we said was that we need to again make an assumption here and say, okay, we are looking at interactive workloads, which are the common case workloads in enterprise data centers, and batch workloads. And Robert described it really well yesterday, the more resources you give to these workloads, the better performance you would get.
And the more they will take.
The more they will take, right? And the question then is, does it make sense to mix a batch workload with an interactive workload? And I guess the answer is probably not, because that batch workload will take as much as it can, right? And there is no control on what the batch workload does, right? And so even if a data center had batch and interactive workloads, it wouldn't make any sense to consolidate a batch workload with an interactive workload.
I mean, unless, of course, you have this idea of giving whatever's left over to batch, and you kind of say, you know, since I don't care how long batch takes, look, I'm just thinking about the CPU scheduling, right? When you look on the mainframe, right? You have two camps, right? You have batch and interactive, and generally, you put interactive as higher priority, and basically, it doesn't matter. Batch will get done when it gets done, as long as whatever IOPS are left. It is almost like a good idea.
Thing, though, is that scheduling latencies for I/O are much worse than scheduling latencies for CPU, right? So if you let the batch workload in, assuming that there is no interactive workload for this moment in time, when the interactive workload does come in, there'll be a substantial latency before service begins for the interactive workload. And I think that makes it even harder to combine batch and interactive workloads for storage.
And one of the things, when we say batch, I think we were really talking, and we're using batch now to describe that, what we were really talking about yesterday when we used the batch label is the scientific workloads.
Okay.
When we say batch, we really mean that. So,
but batch in general means, you know, things that they kind of get done whenever they get done.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But I think we were talking things like, think the Google file system.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't.
And it is.
I think that's a different, they classify that as
distributed
high performance workload or something like that.
Well, Google File System is used for multiple things. It is used for online stuff as well as background stuff, right? So when Google creates their index, that's a batch process, right? And I would suspect that they don't really mix these two together. I mean, if their online query and anything else, let's say related to ads or whatever it is that they do, which requires interactive response times, I don't think they're going to mix it with their indexing workloads. And I think that's an assumption we want to make here to make our life easier. And I think that's a reasonable assumption to make.
It is easy. I mean, it makes it easier. So I agree. I guess my only thought was sort of this idea of when you talk about consolidation of CPU workload, right? And you looked at and you kind of said there's definitely big periods in time in most servers' lives, right, that they're sitting idle. And why am I giving it a dedicated processor?
Right.
So the idea of consolidating it means I can get, in the day when I'm getting all the hits, and at night when I'm doing all the processing, those are real win consolidations there. And I'm just sort of thought.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, and perhaps the Google File System is a bad example.
Yeah, not when you say batch in mind.
Okay, we were really thinking like the scientific computation workloads.
Yeah, no, I agree. Those you don't want to mix those with anything. You just kind of want them because you're going to take, as you say, 100% of whatever you do.
And if I double what I have, it'll take double that.
Now, well, it's just because it's a burnt load of work and it'll take all you can get.
It will never stop.
Yeah.
And that's really when we said batch.
I'm just wondering though, but you know, so if you look at who are those big, there's a lot of big organizations that kind of put your screensaver right, and they chew up your CPU's cycles when you're not awake, kind of thing.
The Boink.
Yeah, I can't remember who I did it with.
RC5.
Yeah, RC5. I did the RC the key cracking one 10 years ago, but you just loaded it. I thought when I worked over kind of the library, I convinced George over there to actually install. We had 200 some odd machines get installed. So we installed the as part of the base image, It's like, hey,
idle cycles, go crack RC5.
Absolutely. So at night, when the library was closed and nobody was there, all of a sudden the screen would kick in, and all of a sudden we just got 250 CPUs worth of bandwidth available to us. And I guess I'm sort of stuck in that a little bit, in wondering if this doesn't, if those cycles aren't something that we could give back, but. I guess that's fine. I'm okay.
Well, hold on. I mean, this is an open discussion. It's a work in progress.
No, I guess I'm just wondering, and I'm still stuck on what you guys said about, why it works in CPU space but not in the storage space, about kind of giving them back. And
the amount of time to schedule I/O to switch back to interactive is a significant impact on the interactive workload for that first hit.
Right, because you're basically got to wait for whatever's in there
to get out.
I'm wondering though if you did it with a lower, if you didn't allow it to queue too much, or you kind of knew you were creating thresholds, so you could kind of throw it in there. I don't know.
Oh, we talked about something like this. It was a rate limiting of some sort to control the workloads. And this goes back to the SSM, the DSM work.
If you knew, that your rate, and you kind of picked a point on there.
Yeah.
And as the I/O rate got higher, you lowered the rate available to your batch workloads, as you're calling it.
However, in that scenario, your batch workload would never really make any true forward progress because it's been artificially capped at a certain rate limit, such that you can preserve the performance for the interactive workload, lending itself to the argument of...
Well, you're not going to drive it. You're right. You're not going to drive it up there.
Right. Lending itself to the argument of that batch workload you really want to put somewhere else then. Such that it takes as much as it can, rips along, and it doesn't impact anything else.
Looking at this discussion from a data center perspective, I think... If we assume that 90% of these data centers would not something like consolidate, so in terms of impact and applicability, I don't think we're going to lose a lot if we make this sort of simplifying assumption.
I'm just sort of, I guess the wondering part of me was, I'm sure the idea of doing data centers, putting two things on one machine was also not popular. And then all of a sudden, and the reasons were very clear at the time. That's why we bought 200 and some pizza boxes, but you come up with a new convincing argument, you know, it's where it's, you know, you kind of made something that changed. You changed the whole landscape.
Yeah, I mean, with virtualization, I think CPU virtualization is way more advanced than storage virtualization right now, because resources can be controlled in a very fine grain with CPU virtualization. You can control precisely the amount of CPU that a VM can acquire and can consume, and also supply minimum guarantees to say, okay, this VM will get at least so much percentage of the CPU. Memory can be divided very cleanly. Well, caching is still a problem, right? And that's a research problem that people are working on, because cache doesn't get partitioned all that easily except in very high-end hardware. But with storage, we don't really have a whole lot of solutions on there as to how do we, you know, first of all, specify shares, right? What does 50 megabytes per second mean? It means very different things for sequential and random workloads, right? So how do I specify? Do I specify in terms of the percentage of time that a workload is using the disk head? And that's, you know, it gets very messy. And with CPU, it's very simple. 50%, 50%. I can do that. But with storage, it's a lot more complex. And we haven't really done a whole lot with, in terms of storage reservations as a community. And I think in the future it will happen, but right now it's not there yet.
Takeaway, I guess it was a takeaway, but it's interesting. No, but I agree, like I said, straight up, that from the percentage of this this model, I agree that it's not meaningful.
Because those types of workloads, and even some of the preliminary work, you know, ruled out that type of stuff. You know, said, look, if you're Sandia, go buy Panassus, go do your own thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is not for you.
Yeah,
you know,
no, agreed. But that isn't what I'm looking at either.
Right.
I'm sort of talking about a different.
There are, for instance, analytics workloads that companies run. eBay has. I listened to this keynote talk at FAST this year.
That was great, by the way.
Did you listen to it?
I shared that with you. The eBay analytics presentation.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, I emailed you the link.
Yeah, so
you're in my spam box. I don't know if people find you.
50 something. Petabytes of analytical BI data.
Yeah.
Sick.
And they have the batch workloads. And from what I understood, they do not let these two things mix at all.
No.
They have like dedicated hardware to run.
And no, that makes sense, of course.
Stuff.
Because it's, even though it is a batch, they really do care when it gets done. They really do expect certain timing on it. You know,
that's,
I mean,
true.
It's not true in my mind, since batches, eventually it'll get done. I don't care. Just handle it and do it whenever you can. And that's really, when you talk about mainframes, that's really what they do. So submit the job, you'll get it done. But don't, by the way, don't interact, mess up my interactive workload. So that was where I was kind of bumping it. But now you're right, when those things, especially with BI, even in our BI infrastructure, we expect it to be done before the close of the window.
That's right.
So you absolutely have to partition it out.
So, yeah, so that's, I guess that's where we are at this point. And then we started, for instance, because we have this modeling exercise, we have to, for instance, identify ranges of parameters, ranges of values for certain parameters, let's say IOPS. What is the IO rates that are reasonable for
input?
For input, because we can keep varying it, you know, there's no limit. And it could also be that, you know, you don't have to really care much about IO rates in this way. So if you generate all these different configurations, they're completely useless. So you want to sort of understand this, because for each of these values, we had to vary all of these other guys. So we had to be careful about what values we pick, for instance, for the IO rate. So I think Robert has been figuring out this sort of range of IO rates which are meaningful for a specific storage hardware, right? And then once we identify that, we can vary all of these in some coarse granularity so that eventually we'll have all the data that we need to potentially construct the model, right? So we have, for this specific IO rate, for this read-write ratio, random sequential, and maybe transfer size, our latency looks like this. So what happens when IO rates are beyond a certain value? So then we have to, so this is the problem where an admin comes in and tells me, okay, here's my workload, here's my storage system, tell me what happens if I make the match, right? And then we say, okay, well, that IO rate is not even sustainable by this storage, right? Because it's outside the range of what is possible to model for this storage system. And then we can say, okay, let's say if I had a few more disk drives, how does this curve look like? Maybe it looks like this instead now, right? So I can go a little further in my IO rate. And if my IO rate for this workload like here, then actually it is supportable by the red storage system than the blue storage system. So that's what we'd like to do.
Right. And that addresses the question we were talking about earlier about what do I need to sustain this? You know, as a higher level question. I have X, what do I need to sustain this? In addition to the consolidation question. So I think those are really the two general questions we have so far. Given this, what do I need to sustain these performance metrics? And
given this
workload,
right.
And I have these requirements for the workload.
So given F of A, comma, unknown.
Right.
And we want latency 10.
Yeah.
Right.
What is the unknown?
Right.
So you want to solve it for one of the parameters, and you also want to solve it for,
yeah, but
given all the parameters.
But you can do that even in this formulation. You can sort of plug in various values of the storage system to figure out, okay, where it
matches. Right. Is it red, is it blue, is it orange, is it green, is it brown?
Yeah. So you can plug in all of those values and see which latency value matches the requirement. And that's your storage system.
Or which possible configurations.
Right.
You might get multiple ones.
Now you will.
Right. You can set up 16 spindles RAID 10, and it'll match your requirements. Or you can take all 16 and make a RAID 0. It's going to match your requirements.
Yeah.
You know? But then there are business decisions based on that you can make. And say, okay, is the data necessarily have to be protected against
failure?
But I
think the better thing that's more telling is you need, you know, 8 disks at RAID 10 or 6 disks at, or something. 16 disks, 10 disks, whatever, at RAID 5.
Yes.
You know, so that's another interesting correlation.
And that was kind of where you talked about the device model, you know, looking at we're going to need some expression of the disk in terms of what it can do.
And so what are we trying to model, put up there, the other, so you kind of talked about what talks about the workload. We haven't talked at all about what the model looks like for the...
We actually have some of that on the first screenshot we took.
Okay.
I think maybe. Yeah, I think we put this on the board one day. You know, but you're looking at like the rotational speed of the spindle, you know, the average seat time. The whiteboard images.
This guy over here? Yeah.
Is it that one? I don't think it's that one. I thought we put this out. Maybe we didn't.
Yeah, I don't think it's in here.
But it's things along the lines of something spreading up. We'll take a picture.
You can erase
soft
them.
PM.
Yeah. You can erase that.
I look at all that looks like soft PM. Can I?
Yeah, you can, yeah, sure.
Like I've seen that data structure before. It looks vaguely familiar. So looking at the device's performance, we're gonna wanna know the number of devices.
Right.
You know, that's for the mechanical case. That says these are probably a little different.
I guess even with SSDs, we would need that number of devices. How many SSDs do you have?
Because of the parallelism that you can take against the packages.
Yeah.
Average random latency.
Yeah.
you know, which is really a function of, in the mechanical case, it's a function of your track switch time and rotational latency would determine your random IOPS.
Yeah.
But for an SSD, it's a little different. You probably, depending on the manufacturer, you might get a different average random latency. The number of the devices, the average random latency, the device, RAID config,
probably need sequential bandwidth. Or instead, we could just call it sequential latency.
Sequential latency or bandwidth?
Bandwidth is probably more appropriate. Yeah.
It's bandwidth of device.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the bandwidth of device container. Maybe a little generic there.
What is that?
If I have a device that's capable of outputting 100 megabytes a second on its own, but a backplane that can only sustain 100 megabytes per second, if all of the devices lit up at the same time, you could not send it all down the backplane at the same time. So that's what I mean by the bandwidth of the device container.
And is it true that usually the container bandwidth is less than the sum of the device bandwidths?
Yes, that is the very common case.
Because you usually have, 60 or more drives can hang off a single backplane loop.
More than that.
No, but usually it's 4 or 5 trays on a single loop. Maybe a single loop is on the 380 of 4 loops.
Right, but I think you get more than that on a single loop in, what do they call it?
So you get
a single loop on the 300, and your maximum trays are 4, right? Or is it 8? It was 4. On the 300.
Well, no, on the 300 it's 4. On the 380, I think you can dangle 8 off one.
Okay, so I guess my question then is,
what is
possible that you can have the container bandwidth less than the sum of all the device bandwidths, but is this condition ever utilized? I mean,
I think they try to limit the number. No, so going to this is, I think they tried to limit. The reason they limit your number was the speed of the back the devices and the speed of the back, bandwidth of the whatever you're calling the container on the loop. That's why they try to match them. That's what I'm saying. So I don't think that they're.
So you're saying strike that?
I think so.
So we could also, sort of subsume this in the assumption that the backplane is not going to be a bottleneck. I mean, just to simplify the device model, right? And I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Because that's all it is really anyway. Well, that's the only reason it plugs into the home run at all, right? Is to make sure you didn't over.
But if we're assuming that we're not going to over,
then
subscribe, overcommit that, then it can fall into the assumption. So bandwidth of the device rate, configuration of the device, average random latency. Read latency. The write latency.
And if it's an SSD, then it's these two values are going to be different. But for disk drives, I think they are more or less equivalent.
I'm just trying to enumerate all of the...
The read latency, they're equivalent? Yeah.
And
I thought there was a lot more time it took to kind of effectively position the head for writing, making sure it was...
True, but here we are talking about random latency. Because if it's sequential, then the latency should be zero.
And
if we are talking about random, then the amount of time it takes for the head to move to whichever track and position it is an order of magnitude more than the amount of time it takes differentiate between read and write.
I think understood he was writing was the amount of time it actually took to do a read operation versus a write operation.
I separated these from the random or sequential.
Because that's a read or so. But
no, wait a minute.
Isn't random or sequential both read operations are equal?
Or
either
or. Right.
So that's why I'm stuck with what you're writing.
Okay.
Help me out.
Which piece of it?
Well, it sounds like you're including the same thing twice. So I guess if I have an I.O.
Okay, that's a bad way to say it.
If I have an I.O., it's going to be a read or a write, period. And it's going to be random, or they're going to be sequential.
Right.
And you talk about a set of them.
Seek latency is probably a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
See, I put up there the average random latency, but that was probably a bad way of saying it.
Okay. Yeah, average seek latency. Average positioning delay, because...
SSDs don't seek.
Yeah, well, and also, even in disk drives, it's not just about the seek, it's also, there's also rotation involved.
To come around, that's the way you want to run.
So the average positioning latency.
So this is now talking about your head is somewhere, and you need your head somewhere else.
Right.
How much time does it take to get there?
And it's a random fact, because it might be on the front and all the way to the back,
right?
Or it might be in the middle.
Right, and that's why it's an average value.
Right, but that's what we're saying, is we're basically going to take the literally track to track and the full seek and kind of average. It's going to be an average.
Yes, and that's what the drive vendors will usually report to you. Right. You look at the average numbers in the back of the box, that's the number that
It's literally the average of those two numbers?
Yeah, and, well, actually, no, it's not the average of those two numbers. You have to integrate, right? Because, and in fact, the average random latency is a latency for one third the maximum distance, because your initial position and your final position can be anywhere on the disk.
True.
And so you have to account for all the possibilities.
Right.
And when you do that, the number that you get is one third the average distance that you need to travel, given that your initial and starting and ending points can be anywhere on the disk. Is one third the maximum latency?
That makes sense.
Because you're usually.
But that's the number we're talking about.
That's the number.
That's that.
Yeah. Plus.
So we're not actually talking. So
plus half a rotation.
Right. So
plus half a rotation.
We have to talk about the time it takes to get there, and then the average amount of time you wait for it to do it, and then you're down talking. Add that to a read or write latency.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't quite, because there is a sort of. Duplication, because from the bandwidth you can compute the latency that would be required to read that off. And once you get there, the amount of time it would take to do the transfer depends on the bandwidth of the device. And we already have that. So we don't really need a read or write latency.
Well, I think we do need a write latency though, because the write, especially in the case of the SSD.
And so far I've just been thinking about disk drives, right? Mm-hmm. And not really thinking about SSDs, because I think that's a completely different kind of modeling that would be required. I mean, the positioning latency doesn't even factor in there. It would, I mean, we could make it zero if we want.
Well, that's really why I was thinking the both of them together. Some of these will be zero.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have a positioning latency in an SSD, you just go straight there.
SSDs are way more complex than disk drives, because they have complex software that does background operations, garbage collection of blocks and things like that. And because of that, the variance in each of those read and write latency values is huge. So you can have a read latency of 20 microseconds, but your read latency can also be 200 microseconds, because there was a garbage collection operation that was in the background, and your read operation has to wait. So it's a much more complex thing.
Well, I was thinking I should have put this down.
That's also a problem, because if you do an average, the average read latency depends on the workload, because the workload determines how much garbage collection needs to be done. And if you have a read-only workload, there is no garbage collection. If you have a write-intensive workload, there is a lot more garbage collection.
And so if you would, in the SSD space, the garbage collection portion of it.
Garbage collection in SSDs is required because you cannot do overwrites.
Right, you have to erase.
You have to erase. So what you have is that when you write to SSDs, so SSDs are composed, and this is, you know, we talked about this in detail in our fall class.
Flash packages.
In spring. Yeah. And so SSDs are composed of erasable units,
right,
which typically, let's say, can range from 64 kilobytes to even 512 kilobytes.
Okay.
And you can write to the SSD in granularity of pages, which are 2K, and you can read in the same granularity, but then you have to erase in these erase unit
blocks. Entire, right, size.
So when I'm talking about garbage collection, what I mean is that as I keep writing, I have blocks which contain garbage because they have been overwritten elsewhere. Right, because
right, you
when,
wrote
when you write
right.
When you write it, you cannot write in place. You write some other place, and then you have...
That's the whole write leveling stuff that's going on.
Right. So garbage collection is required so that you can pull out all the use or the valid data from a single block and reclaim all the space. Right. So that there's a garbage collection online process that's going on, especially when the SSD is doing a write workload. If it's doing a read workload, then this problem doesn't arise.
Mm-hmm.
Read-only workload.
So, but don't most SSD devices erase then write on their front when they go to do it? Or you're saying that they erase them all sort of up front?
See, but the thing is that for an SSD to do erase during the write, then you're erasing a lot more
right.
than you're writing. The erase latency is 2 to 3 milliseconds.
Yeah, it's high. And from what I understood from most of the vendors, they're caching that with like a RAM cache of some sort in front of that,
right.
You know, so that they basically take the write, accept it, acknowledge it, and then go through the headache of erase and write.
Yeah,
if I remember correctly, it's
yeah. This part I haven't seen, I guess.
If I remember correctly, you come in and you write, and then you write,
yeah,
and then you write,
yeah.
Now I want to modify here.
Yeah,
I invalidate the page.
Yeah.
Right here.
Yeah.
At some point, I need to come, and that's the garbage collection we're talking
about. So, but what are you doing? You're erasing the page.
Well,
you have to erase the whole unit.
Well,
the package.
There is a complex layer inside the SSD called the flash translation layer. And this flash trans, if we want to go into this topic, it's like...
I guess it's a
huge topic,
okay.
Because there are many different designs for flash translation layers, right? There is a flash translation layer that is page granularity. Then there are flash translation layers that are block granularity. And then there are flash translation layers that are hybrid, that use both granularities. And most of the SSDs out there are this hybrid variety, because that turns out to be the most efficient for current workloads. And to describe the hybrid FTL, it's going to take a long time. But
I've got a really good paper I got from his class. I'll send you on that.
Yeah.
It's like, but, so thick.
But the high-level bit here is that, I mean, to characterize read and write latency for SSDs is really a complex task. And in fact, people would argue that you cannot capture these using average values, because your average can be very far away from reality. Because to come up with a true average, you need to look at all possible workloads. Because each workload will influence the latency by a different way. And that's not really possible. So in some sense, we cannot have a specification of the latency, but in fact, the latency is a function of the workload and some basic underlying property of the flash. For instance, how much time to erase, how much time to write a page, how much time to read a page. And then we can possibly model what is going to be the average read latency given a certain workload. So it's that's why I think for this work, at least for the first cut, we should probably just focus on this one. Because if we go into SSD, then we'll probably get shot down by the SSD experts and say, okay, well, you're making unreasonable assumptions.
So, you're saying remove this?
Yeah, I would say that we just need 4, and that's good enough.
Well, the position latency decomposes into 2.
Right.
The response speed.
Yeah.
And the average seat time.
Right, but we can probably combine those two into one.
But from a simplicity,
average positional latency.
From a simplicity of use, though, I guess I'm just wondering the numbers that are generally available. I know rotational speed is obviously very commonly known.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, are they 15k RPM or 7k RPM? Blah, blah, blah. That one seems like an easy number if I'm just sort of thinking who's going to use the model.
Storage administrator.
If it's from an academic sense, I know it. You know, obviously it's calculable, like you said. The
two together is fine, but I don't know.
The model itself may...
Yeah, I mean, we could write it out as two separate things.
Let's do this.
But then we might have more factors that we have to consider, I guess.
I mean, in the model, we could combine those two into one.
So let's say positional latency.
Hello? Nope, I'm still in that meeting. So, yeah, I'll call you as another one.
We'll say...
Bye.
So what's the name of that two things together?
Well, positional latency is the two things together. And it's we could use that in the model and say, give me this and give me that, and internally just calculate.
Okay, right.
But it's what we're really talking about is the rotational delay and the seat time.
Yeah.
Average.
Right.
Okay.
Room devices, delay convey, and with the device, positional latency.
Well, when we started talking about things like, okay, what is the cache size? But then I think that sort of discussion is going to be
generated.
Yeah.
That generated into a zoo of complexity.
Yeah.
Granted, nothing is ever going to be ideal because there's just too many things that you can't know.
Mm.
Unless you wrote the device firmware yourself and built the device yourself, and then you're really tied to one specific device and say, I can tell you what this device does.
Now here's an interesting thought, right? So now there's also an assumption for this function that all devices are the same. Right.
We actually talked about that. An interesting...
Then, why am I here? I gotta tell you. Everything I say, he says here.
But no, we did talk about that in saying we acknowledge that if you have mix, and for the purposes of the experiment, I went out and bought a bunch of drives to make sure they were all the same. It's like, because I couldn't scavenge a uniform set of drives. I did it initially, and then I burned out like six. Poor Pod is like, Rob, leave me alone. I've been working for 10 years.
Hopefully, with the controlled IO rate, that will, then the frequency of drive burning will reduce.
I'm sitting on an extra 8 just in case. I got a money bin ready. Lots of drivers. I bought 10. Regardless.
Okay.
So
we are assuming the same number of devices. I mean, same kind of devices.
I would say they don't have to be identical.
Oh, they have to have the same, these numbers.
Class of...
Oh, they just have the same numbers, because obviously it's a function of the device, not...
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just saying what you've written requires them to be the same.
But now what I've seen, I have seen the case, and we talked about this a little bit, that it's problematic. I've seen devices like, hi, I'm a 15K drive, my... average seat time is 3.6 milliseconds. And then you do the math to calculate what your average random IOPS are going to be, and you're somewhere 160, 180 IOPS. The manufacturer will say, we average 210.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, given your speed and seat time, I don't see how you do that. But they have the read cache.
Yeah, and then there's obviously the black magic.
They have the black magic read cache that sits in the middle, and their proprietary black magic algorithm.
And they probably are doing a tested actual average.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, going to be better than...
Right, so we can take this to be the worst case that you're saying and say, okay, given this rotational delay, given the seat time, you're going to get this, and we have to enumerate that as an explicit assumption to say, yeah, you're probably going to get better because you have device-specific...
So is that better, or is it better to actually... I think you've already started going down this path earlier in the conversation, but now it's making more sense. Why go with those particular details? Why not just go with the rated IOPS? Because it's more accurate, right? That's the actual. You're really going to get 210 from the drive, an average IOPS.
But that's only if you're doing randomized.
Right, because the sequential this will impact, and as part of the seat time, you have.
Sure.
Well, the other thing which we could do, for instance, is to sort of...
Full stroke, half stroke. And the drives that I've got, luckily, I found the documentation on them. Gave you the full stroke, the half stroke, and the track time.
Okay.
So for sequential workloads, that actually became really important.
So did you calculate what you thought the sequential app should be? And based on that, was it real? Higher or lower?
What I actually got was way lower.
So,
but it's not the drive. It's not the drive. It's the bottleneck.
I think Mike brings up a very interesting point, which is, well, instead of asking the admin to tell you what these numbers are on the back of the box of the drive, we could run some characterization and then figure out these numbers, right? And then maybe all of these, you know, so many parameters will condense into one or two parameters. One for random IOPS, one for sequential bandwidth. And
yeah.
And then, you know, we don't care about the number of devices because the random IOPS is going to account for how many devices there are. If I have more devices, I have more random IOPS. Sequential bandwidth, the same thing. So we don't have that thing to worry about.
Well, devices we want to know because that's going to be a variant that we want. You know, we don't want to say, I mean, right, we want to be able to look at this model and say, okay, what's the difference between red and blue? Well, the number of IOPS.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not meaningful. We want to know how many devices are in it.
Because I have to buy them.
Because that's how you're going to change from red to blue. You're going to buy 5 more disks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a problem with, you know, now if the function doesn't include devices, I think that's a problem.
Yeah, that's true.
Because the question we said, how many more, one of the instances of the questions in the order is, how many more spindles must I purchase to get this performance for this workload?
And now, I mean, as admins, do you think that's a reasonable question to ask? I mean, does it make sense for me to just go ahead and add a few spindles, and do admins usually do that, or?
Well, I think they certainly do it if you're talking about taking, well, I've got this workload and it runs on, you know, this particular configuration. I have this workload on this configuration, and I want to consolidate them. What do I need? Then they basically say, okay, I need 26 disks. Well, how'd you come to 26? You know, through the model. But why not 24? Why not 28?
Hmm.
I think that is an absolute thing when we go to spec things. I realize we don't use the model yet, but we do that, right? We don't talk about, you know, we say we need this kind of drive and we need this many of them. That's absolutely, I think, the scope of what we're talking.
I think, I mean, you know what would be a valuable exercise is to go through that formal process of spec that you just talked about and contrast it with what we are doing here, right? And then use these two as point solutions for comparison and say, okay, if you were to do spec the way you would before, and this is the answer you would come up with. And how far away is it from, you know, what the model says? How close is the model, or how far away from what is required does the model tell you need to purchase, right? I think it would be a good exercise to just make things a little, you know, the spec process that you just talked about a little bit more formal and describable, and see what admins, are there sort of,
yeah, I'll bet you money that a lot of times the number of drives selected
is higher than what you really
need. No, it is higher, but it is a function of buying, right? Because you, if you came out and told me I needed 16 drives, I probably would buy 15.
Because that's what you get in one tray.
Because that's what fits in one tray. And I'm not going to spend the extra $5, $10, $20,000, whatever it is, to buy a tray to put one disc in. You know, it just doesn't make sense, right? If they come in 15, you either put 15 or you put 30, you know, or something like that. Maybe 7, but buy one tray for, you know, tray for one, it doesn't make sense.
Although, if you look at the HP model,
left hand?
No, the HP monolithic ring model.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a different pricing model, but that's,
they say,
they give you all the cabinets from day one, right?
They're like, here's your storage processing head, and it ships with 12 cabinets. They are empty with blank placeholders in them. You just keep buying drives as you need to. And
that's true.
We would then go through the exercise of saying, how many more drives do we have to put in here?
But then when you drop them in, what happens? What happens?
It re-levels out
everywhere. It consolidates the workload again across all of them.
And that was where I told you initially when I had heard that, I said, that's the DSM SSM question.
Yeah. So the question then I would have is, what is the process that you guys go through today? If you had to ask.
Yeah, I don't think that's on the record.
It's one of these, okay, we do.
It goes like this.
Well, no, it's one of these. We do look at it. You know, we look at.
I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure you guys go through some process, right?
Yeah,
it's not,
I don't
completely
know.
Right. You're not picking a number at random. Right?
No, we look at perfmon numbers. You know, we collect some statistics,
And then we look at that and say, okay, that's kind of good, and how many drives do I need for that?
For this paper, that sort of discussion is very valuable, because then we give the reader some context as to, okay, well, here's what people are doing today, right?
People today, I think most people today, probably go to the back of the company and say, well, what do you suggest?
And whatever the vendor tells them, they go with.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
But even that process, if we can formalize it and describe it, would be useful.
I mean, even
the process of going to the vendor and the vendor coming back to you and asking you questions. I mean, I don't know if they're asking you any questions.
But here's the funny part. So I'm thinking of Angel, which I think is ridiculous.
I told him to go.
Angel basically broke their workload down into the number of users was like small, medium, large, right? You can't really classify.
I told the guy to climb a tree.
Yeah, it was really ridiculous, and they came back. In large, you need 30 spindles. And it's just like,
I'm like, dude, go climb a tree.
You get that.
Really? Go call him a tree?
You just have an investment in a storage company?
And he didn't like me. You know that. Chauve hated me when I told him that. Whoa, you need a 32 CPU SQL server with 120 gigs of RAM. 40 spindles. And I said go call him a tree. I'm not getting that.
32-way.
Yeah, he said a 32-way with 120 gigs of RAM in like 30 or 45 spindles just for the data. And I was like, go climb a tree, man. I said, no. And then I asked him a question, what are you running on? And they ran on less than what we had. And I said, so why don't you own that if you have more users than we do? Because you're hosting us right now. Well, this is support recommendation, so you don't get into trouble. And I'm like,
If you oversize anything.
And that's what Mike and I were saying. So we do.
It'll always work.
And we tell vendors to go climb a tree lot.
So going back to this process, right? And it would be, I think, a valuable discussion to have in the paper to say, okay, these are maybe it's not a single process. Maybe it's either this or that, depending on what kind of storage system you're working with, or
so you're
maybe
saying,
admin expertise. Maybe some admins are more readily ask feedback from the vendor to say, okay, you tell me how much I need to purchase. And other admins think that they know the best about their storage system and their workload, so they're going to go through a process of their own to determine how much.
So you're saying like a background section, almost.
Right? Exactly, a background section.
A background section that says,
yeah,
here are the ways you can go about it.
Yeah,
but here are the flaws with that.
Yeah, and I think writing that out explicitly would be very useful for the paper.
I think it adds value to the market impact.
Yeah,
in true practical application, to say, we know some of you. Wind's blowing at 45 disks today, Some of you say, okay, I have $1 million check, and EMC, you tell me how much I need. And they're like, you need $1 million worth of spindle. Here's $1 million check, thank you for the disk. Other people and vendors tend to hate guys like us. They come in, you need 68 spindles. I'm like, go fly a kite. Why do I need 68? Because of this and this and this. And we're like, no, our math shows us this. So there are... And we have our own fudge factors. But I think going through that exercise to show the value of the multiple aspects you could take and then say, this work resolves that ambiguity.
Yeah.
Such that you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that. And then a lot of what we do today is we do take measurements and we get a feel for what the current environment is. And then we say, okay, well, this is how much we think we need. And then we say, double that.
No, I'm not double that, but okay.
Well, some rough number.
No, I mean, so angel sizing, right? How do we do that? And it really is, as we saw it running on the hosting space, and so if they can do it for that, then we can do it with this.
Right.
With this or that, if it was different. Because it was a little different.
So it's like, it's a comparison that you're making.
Well, the fundamental is it's running today of that day. Last month it was running there. They were hosting it, and we were getting... some percentage of the shared infrastructure, which was, let's say, 30 disks. So we got, we're not fully blown out. We know we're going to at least double the number of
users,
maybe even quadruple the number of users in the system. So, think of that as a double or quadruple the workload. So, but we're going to now be on a non-shared infrastructure, so 30 disks should be okay. It's...
Well, it's...
It is sticking a finger in the wind, but, It does add up. It does.
It
I think this sort of a discussion would, I mean, certainly be useful. I mean,
but this is what we want to solve with the work.
Yeah, I understand and I agree. I really like this idea. This idea, not the talking about the sticking your finger in the wind. No, I think
it's worked for us so far.
But here's the real question. But in any of those scenarios, how do you know what the number of IOPS is going to be? Calculating the workload is going to be. If I asked you to tell me what the workload of Angel is in IOPS before it came, what would you do? You wouldn't be able to do block trace. You don't have it. It doesn't exist. It's not running. You don't know.
Okay. That's a uniquely different problem.
But that's where the problem where we were. And that's the problem with most settings, right? So I'm asking you now, SharePoint. The SharePoint stuff, how many IOPS do you think we need? Don't know.
Because you don't know the workload.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
But that's the trouble facing the average admin. He gets, he's told, listen, you're going to be standing up a SharePoint BI portal. Okay?
That's my thing today, I know.
No, I know, but that's why I'm picking on it. Is you're going to be standing up one of these things, and you need, they said two boxes with 32 gigs of RAM, or whatever the heck they said.
Yeah,
right. You know, okay, no, that's what they said.
Yeah.
And you need, you know, 2 terabytes of storage, or, you know, whatever. They come up with a capacity number instead. And you go, well, so 2 terabytes, that could be just 2 SATA drive. Well, that could be 1 SATA drive, you know. Or it could be, you know, 30 spindles, you know.
73 gig.
You know.
Yeah. RAID 0.
It could be a lot of things. It's one of them is going to perform a whole lot better than the other one. I got to promise you that.
And cost a lot more.
A lot more. But that's the problem. They don't give you that. So then you kind of go, well, what are the IOPS I need? I don't know.
Okay. Well, hold on. So when you get into that unknown scenario, and Exchange is a big Exchange is
there's another one.
Mail.
Hmm.
Microsoft Exchange, the mail infrastructure, is a big one. You, for guidance, and it's not the absolute case because they tell you there's variance within the numbers.
Right, but they give you some guidance.
Microsoft does.
Yeah.
So you can say, okay, based on this guidance from the vendor, which Angel didn't give as much, but Microsoft Exchange did. And then they said you need to go buy 200 spindles, and we laughed at them.
Again, another one. But then, again, hold on to that thought. But that's because we plugged in the wrong numbers into them.
Yeah, I agree with you.
They said, oh, we have 2,000 high active users. We have 0 high active users. You know, we have 0 probably medium users. We probably have 2,000 low active users.
Compared to them, yes.
Well, but we didn't read the definition.
Right. No, I grant that. But I'm saying, in the case where I do not have the workload, you take the guidance if it's available.
Right.
Okay. Say, I'm going to need this type
of
stuff.
But you need to fill in this box. IOPS, read, write.
No, this is the device box.
And it's sequential.
This is the device box. You're talking about the workload.
Yeah, you're trying to figure out what that is, right?
Right, so you take, you know, it's read to write ratio, you know, it's load per user, whatever guidance you get from the manufacturer, and then you're going to have that, I'm solving for X. X equals F of G of H of Q of H. And you say, okay, I've gotten some guidance from the manufacturer to give me G of H, the workload model. And they're telling me that I have a performance problem at 6 milliseconds.
Yeah, I gotta, hold on, pause you there, because I don't think 6 milliseconds is important.
Or, I'm just picking it up.
Right, I think fundamentally, when you're doing sizing, right, no one cares about the latency number per se. What they care, because quite frankly, it's slowly, no, even that too. I'm looking at this graph. People don't care where the y-intercept is. They care about really how long do I continue on the linear.
You mean this guy
section.
Right here?
Yeah.
Right here.
No, they actually care about how long can I stay in there?
In year?
Yeah.
Underutilized?
Well, that's severely underutilized, right? It's severely underutilized because at this point is when I'm issuing an IO request only when the previous one completes.
I grant you that. I think that most people want to be in there or in the bottom half of
probably. I would expect they would want to be somewhere in this range.
Actually,
and maybe in the bottom
I want to be. I don't want to be. I want to be. Honestly, if I'm looking at this, I would probably position my size to be towards the top of the flat section.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Because at that point, you're basically saying, I'll never have any performance that is even going to affect my latency.
Okay, now target the work to a larger business audience that's not the pure sysadmin who wants the system to always run fast and well.
No, because the problem is you're talking about average. You're talking about average I/O range, or are you going to use the maximum I/O range? So I'm saying maximum. Yes, I never want to exceed the point where I start going to skyrocket.
No, but
plus
I'm saying,
I wanted overhead, right? 10% or something.
But I'm saying, think the bean counter, the actuary that works for the director who's in charge of the funding, and he says, "Okay, look, I've got this model, and my guy's telling me that we need to be here, and it's going to cost me $500,000. That's not acceptable."
I guess what I'm saying though is you don't buy if you're scaling CPU. It's a similar argument. If you're scaling CPU, you don't buy at the so I want to keep my CPU at 90%. No one buys like that. They buy, you know, with a lot more overhead in there. They really want them to be low. And I sort of think that's the same thing. I think everybody wants to be right at the point where they're getting the perfect performance.
Okay, but even taking that argument, but I'm still gonna, after I take that point and discuss it, I'm gonna go back to the other point of, you even made this argument to me looking at changing jobs in business. They only spend as much as they have to get what they need. They don't go buy extra.
Right.
Right. So even taking your point, this is still an important point to know. And you have to be able to model that to get that
out. I agree. That's the point we're looking for.
But I'm saying there's additional utilitarian function to the model because you give it to business guy.
Yeah.
An MIS degree.
Well, MIS guys are in a different building, so you don't have to worry about that.
I wasn't aware of where they were. I'm just like,
yeah.
Because I heard a friend speak.
I hear Mike's point, and let me you know follow up on that a little bit. I think what Mike is saying that when you're sizing a system, you typically size for the peak and make sure that your peak doesn't suffer. And you provision for the peak. What we are seeing now is and in you know systems before when there was no consolidation, the difference between the peak and the average would be an order of magnitude. Which is why the average would probably lie in this range. Okay. But now when we start consolidating things, we do not expect, the reason we are consolidating is so that we do not need to provision for the sum of the peaks, but rather we want to provision for the peak of this set of workloads.
Agreed.
And say, okay, the reason we are consolidating is that so we can substantially save money. So what we'll then see is a substantially smaller gap between the peak and the average.
And
because all workloads are running at the same time and they contribute to the average, but then only, you know, assuming that the peaks are not correlated, there would be peaks that occur only one at a time.
The elasticity of the consolidated platform, and this is the DSM-SSM argument, is such that if the peaks do not coincide with each other, the elasticity of the underlying consolidated storage will allow the peak to extend onto all of the disk.
Right.
So it's not the worst case where you have the peaks lying on top of each other.
Right. So it is possible that in a consolidated system, you would move up this line. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much, but it would probably be higher than what you would end up with in an unconsolidated system. So that's one point. The other point, which is a little bit more tricky, is I don't, like you said before, I don't have the workload to begin with, right? But let's say if somehow that I got access to the workload.
Yeah, I was going to go there.
Right? And thing is, I have a workload generation mechanism of some kind.
Right.
But then I need a target to generate the workload against. To get a true value for the workload I/O rate, my storage cannot be bottlenecked when I issue the workload so that I can extract the I/O rate. Because what we would get is not the true I/O rate of the workload, but rather the feedback generated throttling I/O rate due to that storage system for that workload.
Agreed.
So how do we extract the I/O rate for a workload, right? And this, you know, I've been thinking about this because this is not an easy problem, right? Because I have a limited storage system, I have some workload, how do I guarantee that the storage system is not a bottleneck? This work So very recently, I've started thinking about something that recently researchers have, not for storage at all. Actually, no one has talked about this for storage, but the concept of time dilation. So how do you make a system faster than, or appear faster than what it is? So let's say I have a workload generator, which is a CPU, right? And then I slow down the clock of the CPU so that time progresses for the workload much slower. Then I can make the storage system appear as many times faster. Right? So this is something I've been very recently started thinking about, to how to solve this very, you know, basic problem of workload characterization. Because one of the bullet points in our list of contributions is that given a workload, I want to extract parameters of the workload. Some of these are very simple. Read-write ratio, random sequential, transfer size.
If you really get 2 seconds to pass in 1 second, then your I/O actually is now twice as fast.
Right. So and then sense. Can I make the workload believe that the storage system is not really a bottleneck when in fact it would be in real time?
That's interesting.
And then can I extract my I/O? Something to think about. And I think it is possible, but I still need to think more about this.
Yeah, how would you do this?
Yeah, so you can slow down the CPU, and then the I/O rate that the workload will observe will be much more than what the storage system can really support.
So if you went 10 factory, you now have a 10 times faster I/O system comparatively.
Yeah, and this has been used in the networking community primarily because they want to simulate network.
Right, I was going to say this is ultimately goes back to simulation.
Though. Yeah. They want to simulate network bandwidths that are
impossible,
you know, 10 gigahertz or 10 gigabits per second, which or 100 gigabits per second, or even higher, which is not available today. But how do I, for instance, measure the impact of TCP congestion control algorithms on future networks? So this is something that networking researchers have started looking at, this idea of time dilation, but I think that it can be used for this purpose.
Do you have any papers somewhere?
Yeah, I can point you to those, please.
Sure. This is the first I've heard. This is completely new to me.
That's a new idea.
This is, I'd like to read about this, because that this sounds like it.
I mean, I've heard about it in the network space. I've seen that. But I've seen the simulation tools that we've used here, or I forget who does it, but there's...
I haven't seen it.
There was the... What is the guy that does the distributed network?
Jason Liu?
I do remember I took a class and I actually dropped it because I couldn't do it, but it was basically emulation software that he had. He could actually set up the links, set up the hosts, and then...
Is this the Cisco stuff?
No.
No?
Is it Eric Johnson, or...?
No, he had a really, really difficult accent, and that's why I ended up leaving the class. I was like, sitting in the class going half the time, what's he saying?
So. Yeah, we have some professors who have a difficult accent. I think my accent is okay.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. I mean, but, you know, when you're sitting there, you're going, what did he say? You know, you don't want to interrupt every 30 seconds and go, I'm sorry, what the heck did you say? You know?
But,
I mean, there's some challenging folks sometimes. So,
yeah, and you have to take a couple of classes.
But he did
before
a distributed systems class.
Is it Xuching Chen? Or...
Nice.
We have a Chinese professor who does this.
Maybe it was. I mean, it's been many years. Mm. My brain has fallen off as to who it was. You know, you go take a class, right? Not for me.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a great class. I want to follow up on it, but I need a different person teaching it.
Yeah. And I think that's
reasonable. But I've seen it. You basically say this is a 10 megabit pipe or 10 gigabit pipe or whatever pipe you want, and you simulate all the ends, and you say, what are they trying to do? Are they all trying to talk to the server over here? And you can kind of simulate the whole thing. Simulate
anything like that.
Yeah.
But that would be
time dilation is actually, even for the networking community, is a very recent contribution. And I don't think anyone has applied it for storage yet. I think I know for a fact that no one has used it for storage. It might be useful because I think, because of what you said, which is if you don't know the workload, or if you want to characterize the workload, how do you do it? Because to characterize the workload, you need a storage system. And then, because of the limits of the storage system, the characterization that you would do can be skewed.
Feedback into it.
But how do you actually, how would they actually do that? Storage
calculation. Right.
And basically the machine running.
Right. So the thing is that when you have a workload generator, what does a workload generator do? The workload generator would issue I/O at a certain rate.
Okay. And then you just arbitrarily tune it down.
And so how does the workload generator control the rate? It will look at the system clock and say, is it time to issue the next I/O request? And the system clock is dilated, right? And then it will measure time, again, looking at the system clock.
Mm.
So the I/O rate that will observe for a specific storage system would be correspondingly increased. So what you do is, I mean, you have CPU clock ticks, right?
That's what I was
going to
say.
Software that will dilate that. So instead of reporting a tick to the operating system once every millisecond, it would report it once every 10 milliseconds, right? But that tick is perceived as happening once every millisecond by the operating system, because the operating system knows that my ticks come in at 1 millisecond. And then I fool the operating system into thinking that 10 times as much less time as fast than actually has. And so whatever the operating system thinks, it reports back to the application, and the application thinks the same thing, and everything that it reports back to you would also be diluted.
That's cool.
Yeah,
I could see really interesting uses of that in VMware. Like, hold on.
And that's actually where you'd be able to do it better.
Yes.
Because you have that software layer between there. You know, kind of cheating the hardware is a little hard. But the VM is
perfect.
Much easier to cheat.
Yeah.
Cool, because they don't know any better.
Yeah. So you just got to find a way to actually
do that. But I think that can be done. It would require a bit of work, but I think it can be done. And I know whom to talk to about this. Jason Liu is the guy who has been doing some of the time dilation work for his networking research. He doesn't have an accent, but he's very intelligible. So yeah. And so I can bring up this problem with him and see what he thinks.
So going back to the whole thing that got us all started on this.
Right.
So I have some recommendations from the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm going to take those, and that's a G of H. And I know I need some SLA for X. Whatever.
Yeah, I don't agree, but okay. I mean, ultimately, what I see, you don't, right? You really don't care. Because last year, you know, drives were 7 milliseconds, not 6. Now they're 6. Yeah, the average. Latency.
But I think this latency, from what I understand,
that's the SLA latency,
is the latency that the application desires, and which in turn is probably controlled by some user experience factor.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, let's say we need 4. There's not really a way to get beyond a certain threshold today.
No, agreed.
And
agreed.
So I've never seen an application coming back and say it needs 6, or it needs. It means
anything less than 10 milliseconds is acceptable, but if my latency is low...
I don't know that I've even seen that, though.
No, I was actually going to say that. For example, SQL Server.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The documentation says, look, less than 10 milliseconds, you're golden.
What's golden?
SQL. This is a good storage subsystem for SQL Server.
Okay.
Okay, less than 10 milliseconds on that one particular line for whatever mandate is
you have. I'm happy with you so
okay.
far.
They say between 10 milliseconds and 20 milliseconds, you are starting to have a performance problem.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you here. Okay, those numbers were taken in the sense of saying your storage system, if it's at 10 milliseconds or less, it's in that flat line, the flat line zone.
Yes.
Okay, if it is 10 to 20, it's somewhere approaching in that elevated thing. And if it gets greater than whatever, you're going to tell me the next number.
Are they going to say in anything
greater than 20?
Greater than 20.
But I mean, I guess I'm, you know, and then you're going to be, they believe you're kind of peaking off. You're getting into that peak of no return.
It could also be, for instance, that there are multiple reasons why they have these numbers in there. But there could also be some application logic which would say, okay, maybe there is a timeout.
Yeah.
That database connection, okay, anything greater than 100 milliseconds, the database connection is going to timeout.
Right,
or something like that.
That's
right? So there are some requirements.
That's not those, right? I mean, let's be honest. SQL Server, 10 milliseconds, if they were really 20 milliseconds, but sustained at 20, your performance would not tank.
Tank? No.
No, but I guess what I'm stuck is, where I'm stuck on this is, those numbers tomorrow or in 5 years from now are going to be 5 to 10, 10 to 15, or whatever. They're going to be a different layer, and I think that's just because they know the storage systems are averaging, you know, 5 milliseconds today.
True. You're probably right on that.
And I know the timeouts and stuff, I mean, you know, you've felt enough web pages, you know those timeouts are much different numbers.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, those numbers are like 6 seconds. So the ones that are, the real timeouts you're going to hit are the timeouts for the disk subsystem, as long as you don't exceed whatever Windows says is the maximum sleep time.
Right. That's
I'm in a meeting. You're on your way home? Okay.
Or. Okay, in milliseconds, IOPS and latency are related to each other.
No, but yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So
they're only related in the sense of when you get beyond the underutilized part. In this, as the curves, as they start to move up.
Right.
I guess what I still went back to that thing is, what do I want? I want to stay in the low part of the climb, or certainly while the slope is low, right? Not a high slope. It was slow pressure to increase. I don't want to be there. Absolutely don't want to be there. And I want to back off a little so I have some headroom.
Right.
Wherever you believe that point is, it might be at the base, it might be halfway up the tree, I mean up the slope, but you definitely, that's what you're really talking about, is I want to make sure.
Agreed.
And then as your workload increases, you need to slide that out a little bit, so you need to go to red, which is now,
agreed,
gives you more running room, more IOs before you get to that climb.
But for some application workload, you know where you want to be, roughly. Based on, we're talking about the one that you've never seen before.
Right, well, you want to be as long as you're not starting the serious slope.
So you get some guidance from the manufacturer, if possible.
Okay.
Or if you have no guidance, you're going to probably over-provision a little bit. No. At which point, you can then take these quantitative block traces and say, what is it I really have? What is my I/O rate? I know I'm not oversubscribed. Overcommitted.
I guess I'm still with you, but I think it's already perfect. I guess what I'm saying is I don't need to care about the 10 because I believe that is just overall a constant that will move up and down over time.
Mm-hmm.
So we get into solid state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all of a sudden we're down here. But it's still going to be at some point where you hit a sufficient I.O. rate that you're starting to now
trigger garbage collection and
you're well, whatever start it is, right, but you're still going to have that the time where I/O is infinitely distant, or at least it could be, and then you get to the point where you're getting a normalized workload where you can
a fair clip of sustained
right, and then there's a point where you've gone too far, which is that graph there. I mean, it's beautiful. The 10 millisecond part is irrelevant. It's just I'm either way over, you know, I have way more than I need. I'm in the zone. Or I'm over the zone. I mean, I think that's interesting. So what do I want? I want to be either in the zone or before the zone, but certainly not out of the zone.
Agreed. But the question we came out with is, we don't know what the workload specs look like, because this is a new workload. This is where we started.
Okay.
We don't know what that workload looks like, therefore we don't know what the zone is going to be for it.
Okay.
We don't know what the IO rate is. So
that's the piece we're trying to work backwards.
We need to know where we are along this axis to determine whether we are here or here or here.
Okay.
Right.
And that's where I was saying.
But that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's a question of 10 IOPS. I think it's, I mean, 10 IMS. I think it's a question of less than 15 or something like that.
Okay. And you can set this to whatever you want. But I'm saying the general idea of the model is to solve it backwards now.
I agree. But
and say, okay, I have to be less than X. Whatever that is, I know what the workload looks like now because I have it.
Maybe it should be, it has to be, I don't know if this makes more sense or not, but it has to be less than a certain plus. You know, you've got a baseline. No matter what, you're never getting below 10 milliseconds in this graph, right? clearly that's the 10 mark right there, right? And then it starts getting worse as you get to the point where it's not infinitely distant apart. And then it gets really bad. So maybe it's just a question of zero over base, what percentage of a baseline you want to get. You know, this storage system will allow you to stay at zero for 10,000 IOPS, but at 10,001, you're now at 1 millisecond. You've now crossed that
in the zone.
First threshold. You're now in the zone, but you don't want to get to plus 10.
Mm.
You know, and you know, because I know this is going to move up and down. So why don't we just say, what is the systems that will do what you're going to do?
Mm.
What are the configurations that can do what you want to do?
Right, and that you know you'll be somewhere in, but it's all the below the midpoint threshold.
And that's another way to take a new workload and put it in. And then you can take the same model later, now that you have it, and say, trace it
right
at the storage level or the OS level, wherever you want to trace it. Tell me what the workload looks like and is doing. I have the real I.O. rate, its real I.O. footprinting
right
characteristics, and say, I bought X disk because I wanted to be here. And what I learned is, I'm really over here.
Well, right. And
now
then,
I can consolidate.
But I now want to add this new workload. This is all about consolidation. So I'm kind of pulling you away from the new applications. I don't care at the moment with the new application. It's about consolidation. I have two workloads, and I know they're now both there, right? Now, can I consolidate them? What is going to be the new I/O rate, and where? How many disks do I need to add? Goes back to your question. That's why I like. So if you pick and say, I'm here and here on these two existing, they're modeled, and here they are. They're perfectly here, and they're in the zone, let's say.
Am I going to hit
the wall? Let's call it the wall. Am I going to hit the wall? Or if, how do I more or less stay where I am and stay in the zone?
And I think what you're saying now is kind of the higher level abstract questions we started with. Those are the things we're trying to answer.
Right, no, I know
that. Yeah,
that's why I'm saying, you know, I don't want to get, I think we got sidetracked in the idea of what's
the
new workload. You know, in the end.
But the new workload is important to.
And it's another part of the paper, I think. I think that's where you go, or a different paper, that you go and say, now I've got this model, how can I model something that I don't have? You know, how do I put the new one where I don't know what the workload is in?
But see, I agree, but a lot of the value of having a model, you know, is knowing what you could take upon yourself without having to outlay capital to take it immediately.
Right, I know. But
that's part of the value we see in the work, though, or I see in the work, is to say, I have.
But that's just a consolidation workload, right? That's what we're trying to do, is to consolidate. So, can you take, you have today these two, you want to know what you need to buy to not over. You don't want to die double, right? You don't want to take everything and push them together and say, well, since I had 8 disks and 8 disks, I don't want to buy 16.
Right.
I only want to buy 10, ideally, right? Or whatever 10 is. 10 might be 11, 10 might be 12,
right.
10 might be 9. What do I need to do? It might be 8, right? And
maybe
fundamentally,
perfectly, yeah.
Yeah, maybe it just works, and both of them will work together nicely. But I guess I'm sort of stuck in saying, yeah, this is perfect. If you've already know the workloads, you should be able to plug them into the model, see what you have today, and then see what consolidating them and put them back in the model. Does it still fit? Do I need a bigger one? Do I model the bigger one? What do I do?
But see, I would also argue that part of consolidation is taking something that you do not have today and bringing it into your existing infrastructure. And that's a scenario that we get into a lot.
Oh, no, I agree, but that's the next one. So now that you've got this working model, you know where you are, you want to add something new. So what is that something new? Well, it's 100 IOPS, and it's mostly read, and it's mostly sequential, and whatever. And then all of a sudden, what happens if I add that? So the next, so another part of it is, how do I plug into there, and then we just insert it, and all of a sudden we'll see, we're off the top of the graph,
or
no,
nicely.
We're still good. Or even we're still great.
Okay, let me add another dimension to the conversation. Let's say I have a workload that changed.
Mm.
So it was behaving perfectly normally. My latencies were all, you know, in the ranges that I would expect. And I wake up one fine day, the latencies are 10 times as high. Something changed in the workload. I don't know what changed. Maybe a new department started using the same data set for doing whatever it is that they're doing, and they are 10 times as big. What is the problem here? How do we formulate the problem, and how do we solve the problem?
So that sounds to me like now we know we have latency equals F of, we don't have labels from A and B, right? A being
the workload and B being the storage. We know B has remained the same. We know L latency has jumped. So what happened to the workload?
What happened?
Can we go back and calculate what the new workload looks like based on the fact, based on only knowing latency and the storage?
Or I think, okay, I think that's a really good aspect to look at it. Is
that what you're asking?
Is it solvable? But I think what he's asking is how much more do you need to get to accommodate that change?
Well, that too. But I mean, this is an open question at this point. Okay, so what's happening with this workload? First of all, this graph is not correct. Okay, so the reason why I say that is because this blue line is still going to the right. When you're at this point, what that means is your latency goes up, but your I/O rate remains the same because the storage system is throttling you. So what we have is a graph that essentially is like this.
Hey, hit the wall.
Hit the wall.
I think that's where that phrase came from. But yeah.
Okay. So, but these are a whole bunch of different points, and these are a whole bunch of different workloads. Right? What happened to this workload that yesterday it was here, but now it's up here? So what you will see is an I/O rate that's not the true I/O rate of this workload.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because much the storage system is throttling the workload and driving up latency, keeping I/O rate constant.
Yeah.
Right? That was my reason why I, you know, went into this direction of time dilation, because now I have a way to deal with this workload to determine what its true I/O rate is. I dilate time so that it experiences a storage system that looks
yeah, 100 times faster, 10 times faster, whatever.
Looks like this, right? It keeps going and then starts increasing, so I can really extract the true I/O rate for that workload. And then I will know, okay, for this I/O rate, what kind of storage system do I need that will still, you know,
right,
lie in this first.
So theoretically, part. It's a question of adding more devices, but
yeah,
I mean, or something else.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, I think that's a reasonable problem. I don't know if it's a real problem, but is that something that's
in town? It all goes back to the same, it is the same thing.
That's, I'm talking about different aspects of the same thing.
Hmm. But, I mean, that's why I said workload characterization is interesting and also important, because you run into workloads which are sort of, there are artificial aspects to this workload because of the limits of this toilet system.
Right, and I'm sort of thinking, you know, Rob's batch, definition of batch, goes back and, you know, are those going to be, are there really an I/O rate associated with them, or do they really just do is churn over as fast as you give it? You know, if you really are I/O bound, is there an I/O rate that will satisfy you? If all you're doing is read the sense of reading, right? Get it. Okay, I'll give you 10 times faster storage. Get it. Okay, I'll give you 100 times faster storage. Get it. You know.
Okay, I'm sure at some point you will.
Well, then will you just basically found the true I/O rate, which is the fact that the CPU can't generate I/O requests?
No, well, see, there are some workloads which are user-facing workloads, right? And then you have limitations as to what users can do, right? So if you have 100 users, they can generate IOs only at a certain rate because of things that do that eventually generate IO requests.
Okay.
Right, so these are the class of interactive workloads.
Right, yeah, there are real ones that you'll find real limitations, but there are either workloads that are...
Right, then there are batch workloads
that will give you everything, you know, take everything you got.
Right, which is why I think we have the stress on the latency, because interactive workloads, latency matters. For batch workloads, latency probably doesn't matter.
It matters absolutely when you've hit the wall, and now the numbers just keep going up no matter what you do.
Yeah.
But I as long as they're...
For a batch workload, the latency would go up. I mean, the latency would always be up the wall because, you know, it's constantly generating requests. And
right. But even with dilation, it'll still be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
yeah,
I agree.
Dilation doesn't solve the problem for batch workloads.
Right. Well, it doesn't really solve any problem. It just lets us look at the problem differently. you know, because we're not really going faster.
Mm-hmm. We just know how far out we need to go. Yeah.
Right, right. So I guess what I'm thinking is, oh, I got stuck there. I got lost someone.
But to go back to your batch workload question, so you dial API rate, you say, I need this, and then you say, great, it's not really storage I need. Yeah. I need...
You could dial it so far out and it'll still
work. I need a petabyte of RAM to put the data set in memory and just work with it there.
And it's still going to be too slow.
Well, yeah. Maybe.
Well, because it's effectively as much as you can.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
Right. But you do that to some point till you say, okay, I am no longer I.O. bound now.
I'm CPU bound.
I am CPU bound.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You will find that rate.
That's what I'm saying about no matter how much you dial, eventually you find out that.
Well, but then you see, but then you switch the problem back to somebody else's arena. You're like, hey,
so,
CPU guys, you have a problem.
Yeah. Right. So here we are. I guess the question was, right, we went to this. Can you write the formula up there so we have some usable terms?
Right, what formula?
Latency equals function of something, comma something.
Oh.
I keep going, trying to say it, and I know I can't because we don't have to agreed upon terms. You know, N, you know, it's just not defined.
Latency in milliseconds equals the function of the workload characteristics of some workload.
Can't see, go ahead, yeah.
Plus the storage characteristics of some device.
Yeah, good. Thank you. At least now we can refer to S and W and all these things meaningfully instead of saying that other argument. So we have the ability now to solve for any of the three missing ones.
Given the other
two. You know you want, and that's the problem I have with latency. I mean, it is perfect, but it's not what I want. You know, because if I say to you solve for five, for four, you're stuck because there's nowhere on the graph that ever returns in four. It's always a minimal of five because that's...
Okay, and that's where we said there are a hard bound. There is a hard bound.
No, I know, but...
Here... And a hard bound here, and here you return, oh, you're over.
Infinity, and
you know, yeah, return, okay, negative infinity over here, positive infinity over there. No, I'm sorry, it doesn't work. Go away.
No, I guess that's my thing. That's what I'm saying is what I really care about is how much I am over my minimum L. My minimum L is 5. And I get minimum L for a certain, for my workload, and a certain, for a given workload and a given storage system, I get it for a while, right? Until it becomes such that, you know, it now is having to really work. And then we get a number and it starts climbing. And then at some point we hit the wall, which is, you know, at that point you can describe it to just go to infinity. You know, we can say that as soon as we hit the wall, it's you know, kind of lost its functionality. And this seems really useful as being able to stay in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm saying is now we can solve for, give me all those that have a less than or equal to 0, or less than or equal to 5, which 5 might be the middle of the zone, right? And 10 is sort of the top of them, based on what you said. Less than 10 milliseconds is good. 10 to 20 is bad, right? So we kind of say at the top of that graph, or the top third of that graph is, you know, 10 to 20, and 20 is that point where you start going off into forever.
That's an awful lot of combinations. It could satisfy that.
Well, yeah, but now you apply the min function. What is the smallest S, sorry, got looked in the wrong thing. What is the smallest S that will serve the need, will serve W, and give us still a 0, less than or equal to 0, plus 0. And then I go, okay, that's the storage system I need to buy. That's the minimum storage system.
And it's configured.
Yeah, minimum number of these kind of disks. That's really what it boils down to. That's the minimum number of these kind of disks.
In this configuration.
They'll give me my, put me there. And you go, okay, well, that's great, but I want some overhead. Okay, well, then you pick, you know,
how much overhead,
the percentage overhead over that, right? And you can say, okay, now it's plus 10% or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it also allows you to say the question of, okay, I know I've got this workload. I know I have this new problem latency. So what's changed about the workload? And you can kind of go back and say, you know, IOs and rates increased or something's increased, you know, whatever it is, the IOPS, you've changed the behavior of the workload. It's now very random where it was very sequential before, and that's why it doesn't do it. You know, and that's really easy. I can see that happening very easily. You plot out something that's very sequential, and you just get a little sprinkling of something in there that's random now,
and all of a sudden,
you're up that hill.
Mm-hmm.
So now you got to go, what is that? I mean, I see it very useful. I can see it I can see it going in there and bonking someone we know with a certain initial, as you call the purse screen magistrate, and actually being able to
Pennywalker.
Yeah, the Pennywalker. And come back with this. No, but I see this is really useful.
We're talking. Did you see where I want to beat him over the head with this?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
Because I want to come back and put down the numbers and say,
this is the min. This is the min of SD. Don't you understand it? You know,
here that's it is. Right. It's like, look, here it is. There's no argument with it. If you don't buy that, you will have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the penny walker walks around and says, no, here's two pennies instead of the four you asked for, I'm like, you're going to have this problem. I will buy the two now. Don't run it. Look, you have the problem. Now, why don't you go buy the other two?
Yeah. Well, that's what it is. It's someone who's, yeah. I think it does address, and it's true in every organization, right? You have the bean counter, and Rob kind of brought up the bean counter, and you have the folks, the admin who really kind of wants it as far left as possible.
Right, and this tool will suit both parties.
Yeah.
This tool
But it does allow you to find a common ground.
Well, that's it, exactly. This tool will let the bean counter and the exec turn around and tell the storage admin, yes, that's a nice config. No, you don't need it. It's too expensive. And what you really need is this.
Yeah.
A quantitative model that says, this is really what you need.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And we'll let the storage admin go back to the bean counter and say, look, you shelled out $25,000 for 14 spindles. This is not enough. I told you we need 28. Here is why we need 28. He has something to protect himself with to say, you're only going to give me 14. I'm going to put the working model on it. It's not going to perform. We're going to have this problem. When it comes, you say, I told you. Now shut out the other 25,000. It works.
He's a little bit excited.
It works both ways.
No, I agree.
And that's
why I'm interested
of the paper.
I agree. And that's why. But the thing is, I like things, and I think you do too, that either are one and zero, kind of simple.
Well, that's why.
Okay. So, but zero is at the base of that graph. It's zero. It's the latency above and beyond what is required for the what do they call it? The what's the word I use all the time? People get mad at me.
Trivial?
Trivial. It's beyond the trivial latency. The trivial latency being the latency that you're going to have no matter if you're doing one IO per day.
And you know what? We may hate this tool.
Because like
Pennywalker might turn around, roll up the paper, and hit us with it.
Yeah, no, he's right. But it's still. But he might be right, though. He'd be right then.
But
that would be useful if he's right.
Yes, exactly.
I hate when he does what he does. But
if he's right,
he's right. At least he's right.
Quantitatively right,
and you can support it.
Yes, and that speaks to the marketability of the paper.
But anyways, I think that if you define these numbers as you're in the zero zone, you're in the zero to ten zone, and then in your ten plus zone, and then you don't want the. Don't want 10 plus.
The thing is, I mean, I'm glad you brought this up about not being in the zone. This zone actually is very interesting because it's, if you think about a sequential workload, the zone probably doesn't even exist. Because if you're doing sequential, you go beyond a certain rate.
And it just...
You cannot do any more than that. Sure. And as long as you're below that rate, your latency probably is going to be at this minimum value.
Okay.
Because that's bound by the bandwidth capability.
It's a pretty fixed point.
It's a fixed point in terms of latency as well for a sequential workload.
Okay, I'll buy that.
Right? So what I'm expecting is that a sequential workload, the latency, of course, will be much lower because we're doing sequential.
Which we have seen.
Right. And I'm going to probably go much, much higher, right, in the IO rate as well, because I'm doing sequential. But then when I hit that point, I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Why does that not occur for a random workload? The reason it doesn't occur for a random workload, here's one reason, is because when you're issuing requests at a rate that is in this zone, zone one, let's say, let's call this zone one, two, and three is actually this infinitely going up. If you're in zone one, then each random access is going to incur a random moment because the next IO is issued only after the previous one completes, right? If I issue IOs faster, what's happening is that there's queuing inside the disk.
And
I can reduce the head movement because of scheduling optimization.
Yeah. We talked about that in class, right?
Right.
Where you question if you doing the full swipes or
right.
CLoke versus CScan.
And depending on the rate, and I think we saw it in the characterization that you've done with the random workloads, we've seen this behavior, right? And that's because the disk becomes more and more efficient until it hits a point, of course, that it cannot just sustain.
Right? You didn't make that
and then you go up.
That the device is, the disk is a funny type of device like that. At some point, the more work you give it, the better it gets.
To a point.
To a point.
Yeah. And that's the zone.
Yes.
Right.
That's
and here, the latency that we are looking at in this zone for a random workload is the latency for that I/O operation plus the queuing latency.
Yep.
Right? Because if you were to look at just the latency of the I/O operation, it'll actually go down. Because initially, the latency is going to be higher, but then over time, for that specific I/O operation, the latency is going to be lower because of scheduling optimizations.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But then, that's not real because the scheduling comes with an overhead of queuing. So you had to pay the price of queuing. So you see that in the latency value that you observe from the storage system. But in fact, the I/O itself is much more efficiently done than it was being done here. Right? So that's why we're going to see this and then that for a random workload. But for a sequential workload, the zone doesn't exist in some sense.
And the preliminary work from the graphs that I picked up generated.
And that was, I was thinking about that.
It went.
Yeah.
He's right.
No, it makes sense because
yeah.
You're already got all the efficiencies you're going to get because
that's
you're
right.
Doing them sequentially. No, I agree. It's a very accurate term.
And if you look at the graphs, I did send you the random graphs. It's actually like this, and then it steps up a little bit and moves over, and then it steps up and moves.
Yeah,
but
that
you,
stepping behavior was interesting.
But if you apply a linear fit,
mm-hmm.
It is the zone, one,
yeah.
Two, and three. Until it just went, okay, I'm up here, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah. I need to see that.
I'll send that out to you.
But then, so now it becomes a very nice model, I think,
mm-hmm.
Where you basically are saying, where am I, you know, where am I in this? And you want to be obviously one and two. The left of two, the right of one, right? So you're
mm-hmm.
Not so over, you want to be at that point, the sweet spot, maybe we'll call it.
And for a mixture now, I mean, workloads are not completely random or completely sequential, right? We have a mix of sequentiality and random.
30.
Well, it could be anything, right? Yeah.
Then how does it look like, right? And that's going to be somewhere in between these two forms of behavior.
Mm-hmm. I would suspect it will probably look more like blue storage on that graph. Some change in, and perhaps a multi-step.
Well, you know, the stepping that you saw, I'm starting to think, what if that is really, you know, behaviors and different behaviors in like caching algorithms, something where you really did change the way you're now, oh, it's this rate? Well, let's use this other.
It could be, yeah.
And that's why all of a sudden the characteristic changed.
Well, yeah, but in this experiments, I think at least the rate controller cache was disabled.
Yes,
and
no caching.
The disk cache, the read cache, of course, cannot be disabled.
The drive cache, no.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe we're hitting something, though. It's definitely something artificial.
Yeah.
Getting steps.
Let me draw that. That's still poor, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
Perhaps the mix.
I saw something more on the lines of, okay, I have this, and then I have sort of this sort of stuff. Is this what I saw? So for a certain range of...
Yes, I'm applying linear fit to that.
Oh, I see. So these are just connecting the points. Oh,
that's,
okay.
That's this is the connection of those points. So it actually did something like this.
See, because this is... This
but
is
new.
I know, but... I understand that you're, you know, connecting, but this is these are real points. These are real points that you got, right? Which means that for a range of I/O rates, the latency actually doesn't change. So if you look at these numbers, there are these behaviors.
Well,
in the
that
ranges.
Graph is log base 10 scaled.
Okay.
So that line looks flat, but it's not really flat.
I see.
If you didn't log scale that,
mm-hmm.
You would not see the granular detail. You'd have to chop off the end of the graph. Because remember, if I didn't log scale the graph,
mm-hmm.
This would have dominated this, and I would have had something that looked like that on the graph.
I see.
So I had to scale it to some log base such that I could see what the pattern looked like, and it yielded this pattern, but within the actual data points, there's... It's stepwise, it still is, but there's more of a slope like that.
Nice. Okay.
So it kind of looks like this.
Nice.
I mean, I have to go look at the data extensively now on a case-by-case basis, but I think that hard step nature, I mean, there is a step nature to it, but the hard steps, and then look like a plateau, is a result of log scaling the graph.
Right. And I think what you can do, I mean, when you're plotting it next time, you can chop off the y and
exactly.
say, plot only this part, and then do a linear scale and see what happens.
Yeah, and those graphs are actually conducive to doing that. We can easily go in there and change that. But I just generated that to show, because we were really looking for, hey, when did that happen on this equipment? You know, we were looking for the extreme cases, and I said, you know, I'm not interested in the detail of the shape.
Right.
I just want to know when it tanked off that way.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the log scaling might have affected what those lines really did look like. I'd have to go back and exclude the upper end IO rate, show me this range, linear scale it.
Is it 7 p.m.? It's 8 p.m.
I was like 7. That happened a long time ago.
No, usually they turn off the air conditioning at, you know, after office hours.
Maybe it's like a daylight savings time thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're just happened to be that they're following the old schedule or something.
I was about to say, how much do you want to bet that the equipment is still running on the old daylight savings time code?
That's what I was saying.
You figured it out.
It could be, yeah. It could
some poor little Windows 2000 box.
So I think it's 8 o'clock. I didn't realize that, but I think we'll have to stop now.
So do we have a takeaway from what the next, between now and the next meeting is?
I think we can analyze the data that you already have a little bit more. And what I would like, maybe you guys can discuss a little bit, and maybe Robert can write it out, the background parts, and what happens today, and what maybe there are multiple scenarios that we can discuss, not in a whole lot of detail, but to give some background to the reader, because remember that it's not just sysadmins who are reading, who would be reading our paper, a whole bunch of
actually probably
other people
who
have no idea what sysadmins do at all, right?
Yeah.
And it would be really valuable material to have in the paper.
I definitely think sysadmins are probably not going to be reading it until we can make it where they realize the value of it.
Actually,
I don't see any sysadmins that read academic papers.
Well, I think that it's changing. I think that it's sort of a feedback. I think there's a lot of things like what we are doing right now happening, right? People out in the field are, and the other reason why this is happening more and more is because industry, especially for the storage research, there's a lot of industry involvement. And there's a lot of companies, and the people and the researchers in those organizations get to talk to the people who are managing the systems.
Now, I'll be honest with you. We work in a vacuum, and what we see may not be typical.
I don't know about that, but okay.
We work in a vacuum in Miami-Dade.
Yes and no, but we still also talk to the industry, too.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
They want our money.
Go ahead. Get your point, though.
How many CS people do we have in our department?
Yeah, this is a small number. No, I agree. That's why I said it. I said most CS admins and sysadmins are not CS people.
But that may not be the true case in the rest of the industry. It may be. We're disproportionately underrepresented at Miami-Dade.
Possibly.
About that. Possibly.
Okay. Sure, I'll leave it with you.
But no,
I think that the sysadmin job is an MIS field a lot of times. It is! Okay, sorry.
Okay.
Anyway.
No, you're right. It probably is because it's in...
That's their job.